Hey, fellas, I got a couple of my buddies here. I thought I'd give them the grand tour. Think we can go inside?
Be serious. You have your authorization cards.
Right here.
Watch the door.
Wait, boys, wait. You're making a big mistake.
You made the mistake.
No, you gotta listen to me. I thought you boys understood. It's business. That's all it is. You still don't get it, do you, boys? There ain't no countries anymore. No more good guys. They're running the whole show. They own everything, the whole goddamn planet. They can do whatever they want. What's wrong with having it good for a change? Now, they're going to let us have it good if we just help them. They're going to leave us alone. Let us make some money. You can have a little taste of that good life, too. Now, I know you want it. Hell, everybody does.
You do it to your own kind.
What's the threat? We all sell out every day. Might as well be on the winning team.
It's Friday at 6 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 22nd of April 2022. We're not quite sure whether we're going to be going onto the 6 o'clock slot every week, but it looks like it might be happening quite a bit. We are streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, relentlessly gaslighting us with its military-grade psychological warfare, Ukraine propaganda. And what about that medical misinformation where tens of thousands of Brits died unnecessarily? London media lies now apparently forgotten. Transmitter and printing press owners hell-bent on turning society into a hostile environment for readers, listeners and viewers. The sarin gas media herding, if they can get away with it, tens of millions of us into World War III and into the metaverse. Instead, navigating us calmly, for the most part, through the Fourth Reich matrix is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In part one today, we kick off with COVID and, more appropriately, the jabs. Mark Stain on GB News explains that government statistics are proving now and have proved over the last few weeks that there are three times more people dying who've had the COVID booster than those that haven't had it. And the interesting thing is that he's done all the maths, he's done quite a good job on explaining it, that there are almost exactly the same, well, roughly the same number of people who haven't had a booster than have. So why is it that the booster people are dying at three times the rate of those that haven't had a booster? Fascinating, very important piece, of course, totally ignored by the mass media today. Also this week, Piers Corbyn is the victim of road rage as a Tory MP crashes into him, drives one of his legs into the other leg, bruises him, and there's now apparently an investigation. We speak to Piers. Also, Partygate. What is going on here? Is this just a kind of slow-motion death of Boris Johnson, or is it just simply a way of applying pressure to him to get him to sign on the dotted line when it comes to Ukraine and other political decisions? And amazing article, you couldn't make it up, when David Icke met Jimmy Savile. But the point is, why has David Icke been lying about never having met Jimmy Savile at the BBC? When the documentary that went out on Netflix a couple of weeks ago, a very British horror story about Savile, actually showed images of David Icke interviewing Jimmy Savile on his programme. And as the author suggests of this article, it may well have not been the only time that Icke had interviewed Savile. So why lie, David? In part two, we have an exclusive with Scott Ritter, who looks at the sinking of the Moskva, the flagship of the Black Sea Fleet, just before Easter. Actually, it's the Orthodox Easter this weekend over in Russia. And also, looking at phase two in Ukraine. What is the big differences about now and the previous? So what are the Russians actually doing? Of course, they're not really telling anybody, but Scott has worked it out. He thinks what's going on. And also, amazing documentary on, not a documentary, a discussion programme billed as a debate on BBC Radio 4 called Where's the Line? This is all about the line between NATO getting involved in Ukraine and not. The BBC billed it as a debate, and yet they had four people on that programme, all of whom hate Russia. In fact, they were very, it was really just a question of to what degree they wanted to bash and beat Russia, so there wasn't a debate at all. Martin has also mentioned that there was an attack at RAF Welford, which is on the just north of the M4 between Bristol and London, and it's used to store weapons. It's one of those, it says works unit only. I remember Mark Thomas, the comedian, doing a programme about it years ago, saying, what's this works unit only? You drive up here and you get to a military base. Well, that's RAF Welford, and it's where they store munitions. So was that the Russians attacking RAF Welford with some sort of intelligence that the British were somehow involved in sinking their big ship? Well, who knows? Maybe it was some kind of false flag at Welford. But anyway, we'll be looking at that too. A brilliant interview by Sergei Lavrov, the gentleman, by India Today this week, where he really takes apart, and we'll be hearing some extracts from that, where he takes apart much of what he sees as the whole situation in Ukraine, how it got put together, and also particularly about the British and about the what he says is disinformation coming out of Britain about Russia for many, many years. He takes us through his take on all that. Also, we wind up by looking at the Nazis and the environmentalists with Mark Musser, who wrote a book about that, and also an amazing find, which is now going up for auction. 90 reconnaissance photos, something like 40 battle plan orders, originals, top secret documents from Operation Market Garden going on auction. Also, three maps of El Alamein, the El Alamein battle, a dagger, a red beret, etc., medals, which have been collected by an individual, and then now they're going up for auction. And you know, my part of my mission is to make sure that this stuff goes to somebody and or to a collection or whatever that's going to make them available to the public rather than, you know, squirrel them away. So quite a lot to get through tonight. We'll have until 9 cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, the Iranian Russian news now cancelled by the telecoms cartel, then Ofcom. Oh, and by the way, isn't that interesting? Now Ofcom are going to be in charge of deciding what you're allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say on the internet. Now they've got rid of Russia and Iran from our TV screens. They're going to be getting rid of you folks too, no doubt. But we're not, they're not, none of this is cancelled here. We do it all just as it should be done. Now, Martin, we're going to start this week by asking you, I mean, before we actually hear the clip from Mark Steyn, what do you make of this idea that potentially the booster jabs, people who've been got the booster jabs could be, and in fact they are, I think we can fairly say that from the official statistics from the Department for Health Security, or whatever they're called these days, they're saying that if you have a booster jab, you are three times more likely to die, people of all ages, generally this is an average of all ages, than if you haven't had a booster jab. So to have the first jab may be okay, the second one, but if you start going for the booster two, it's actually can be pretty dangerous and more likely to hospitalise you, etc. Now, we've been told the opposite.
Well, I'll have to hear what this guy's got to say. Obviously, I don't know until I've heard it. The thing about the booster jabs, of course, is that was Pfizer or Moderna, the booster jabs, whereas the original jabs were AstraZeneca jabs. So the booster jabs are the mRNA vaccines.
Yes. So, I mean, I've also anecdotally heard about, for example, people being told you're having a booster jab. They say, oh, can I have an AstraZeneca? Then they say, well, maybe. And then when, of course, it turns up, you're given an ultimatum, really. Either you have the mRNA booster or nothing. And a lot of people are afraid. They're thinking, oh, well, I better have that then. But it all just seems to be a way to coerce people. Anyway, let's have a listen to GB News' Mark Steyn, who was talking last night about this.
Let us start with the basics. There are approximately equal numbers of triple vaccinated as of the combined total of single, double and unvaccinated. This is from the UK Health Security Agency's report last week of April the 14th. Let's take a look at this. As you can see, from a pool of 63 million down at the bottom there, 63 million, there are 32 million who are triple vaccinated. That leaves just under 31 million who are either double, single, or unvaccinated. So we have two groups of similar size, 31, 32 million. So it's relatively easy to weigh the merits of the third shot upon group A versus group B. Here are the COVID case numbers from the government report. All the numbers here come from up to a couple of weeks ago. And if you look at this, this shows COVID-19 cases by vaccination status. So the triple vaccinated in March were responsible for just over a million COVID cases and everybody else 475,000 COVID cases. So the triple vaccinated are contracting COVID at approximately twice the rate of the double, single and unvaccinated. Got that? If you get the booster shot, you've got twice as high a chance of getting the COVID. In the United Kingdom, there's twice as many people with the third booster shot who got the COVID as the people who never had the booster shot. So the court eunuchs of the appalling groupthink media have retreated to reduced claims for the vaccine. Oh, sure, it won't prevent you getting the COVID, but it will lessen your likelihood of being hospitalized. From the same report by Her Majesty's government that I cited just a moment ago, let's check that one out too. You see there in the far right-hand column, that's the people with the third COVID shot. And then you see sort of in the middle the people who aren't vaccinated at all, that number 147 at the bottom. So triple vaccinated people who wound up spending a night in hospital, 6,750. Everybody else, 3,576. So the triple vaccinated are being hospitalized overnight for COVID at approximately twice the rate of the double, single and unvaccinated. And one notes in particular the significant differences in hospitalization numbers in those over 60. So that leaves a sole claim for the efficacy of the heavily promoted booster shot. Oh, sure, it won't prevent you getting the COVID or being hospitalized, but it will lessen your likelihood of being dead. And again, from the same report by HMG, deaths within 28 days of positive COVID tests in all age groups. And the triple vaccinated, again, in the far right-hand column there, and everybody else, the other columns. Triple vaccinated who are dead within 28 days, 1,557. Everybody else dead within 28 days, 577. So the triple vaccinated are dying within 28 days at a rate approximately three times higher than the rest of the population. Why aren't we talking about this?
Well, we are talking about it here, but he's quite right. Nobody else is really talking about that, Martin. I mean, I've heard constantly claims that, oh, well, if you have the booster, it will help you not, it won't stop you getting COVID, but it will just mean it's less serious. From these figures, it looks like the opposite is true. It's actually more serious if you've had the booster.
Yes, and I hear what he's saying there, but you've got to take into account the possibility that the people who have been triply vaccinated are the most vulnerable. That's why they've been triple vaccinated, and they're the ones who are most likely to die.
Well, I think surely people get triple vaccinated because they're asked to do it, they're told to do it, they have to do it for this sort of thing.
Indeed, but I mean, it may well be that the people who are triple vaccinated are going to be the most vulnerable. That's what they will have been recommended to have the triple vaccine. They're the most vulnerable section of the population, and therefore they're the ones most likely to die whether they're vaccinated or not.
Excellent point. But anyway, the fact is we're not being told about this at all, whatever the reason for it.
No, it's certainly worth considering.
Mark is, I mean, he's saying actually it's more deadly. It's you're roughly twice as likely to actually have a COVID case, whether that means you're sick or not, of course, is another problem, another question. And you're roughly double or twice as likely to be hospitalised, but you're three times more likely to die if you've been triple vaxxed. So it sounds to me as if they're a bit of a no-brainer. But anyway, let's have a listen to what Mark has to say about the this whole business. I mean, we're starting to get familiar with this now, aren't we, of the what the groupthink in the London media is all about.
Why are we not supposed to talk about this? This is an interesting trend line. Even in as sick and constricted a culture of free speech as the United Kingdom's, it should be possible to cite official government numbers without being cancelled or investigated or shadow banned on Twitter or being labelled as misinformation. It's not possible. Just back in the day, do you remember the days before March 2020 when we still had medical ethics? Remember those things, medical ethics? It's not possible for a citizen to give informed consent to a vaccine unless he's informed. So the groupthink media's quashing of these numbers is highly disturbing. For another, the inference is that those zombies who mindlessly follow the science must keep following the science, which means following government spokespersons, have injected themselves with something that increases their likelihood of infection, hospitalization, and death. Dividing everything into official and disinformation has prevented honest discussion and had an undoubted chilling effect on public discourse with respect to the COVID, the lockdown, the NHS, the schools, and more. You can see it in any media production office. Oh, I was thinking of doing something tonight on the failure of the so-called booster shot, the third shot. Gee, we don't need another Ofcom complaint. Let's just stick with Harry and Meghan. The hasty rollout of an at best useless and at worst decidedly dangerous third shot is a valid subject for the public square, and I assert the right to quote official government statistics. And because these numbers suggest an unnecessary tragedy amplified by this soul-crushing groupthink in the UK media, I want a royal commission. Let me know your thoughts, gbviews at gbnews.uk, or you can tweet me at gbnews.
I think GB News is quite a fascinating, I mean, very weird the way that they have targeted the major cities, like places like Manchester, where they're there on Freeview. In most other parts of the country, or the rural parts of the country, you can't pick it up at all. And that would seem to me to be its natural, those are the people that would naturally want to watch it, but you can't get it on Freeview. I suppose a lot of those people, wealthy people, have got satellite dishes and all sorts of other ways of, I don't know what they are these days, of picking up your TV, which you pay for, using Sky or Virgin. Wash your mouth out with soap. But anyway, so, Martin, this whole media thing is a major part of this plandemic. It seems to me that the medical misinformation, I mean, this is what I say at the beginning of every programme, and at the end, the medical misinformation is not something that we have been doing. I mean, I've had countless videos taken off by YouTube, particularly with Dr. Stanley Laham in Florida, the retired immunologist, who, by the way, he picked up on the use of reverse transcriptase in the body to put the DNA, to change your DNA, the possibility that that could happen. One of the first people in the world to call that out as saying, well, look, you know, if you're going to use an mRNA vaccine, you've got to be extremely careful because you might end up actually altering the human DNA with it. And that, of course, is immediately taken down for medical misinformation. And yet we've had this government and media saying, well, we must get a booster. It could potentially mean actually that you don't need a booster. It's not going to do you any good. And really, the motivation is profit, not patient health.
Well, yes. I mean, we've debated this at great length over the months that this has all dragged on. And there's plenty of, you know, we've got to be careful to be very precise about what we're saying. Because, of course, mRNA vaccines are not the same as other vaccines. Other vaccines are not based on that technology. And, of course, the efficiency or otherwise of lockdowns is a separate question.
Ah, lockdowns. We could talk about China because they've just had another lockdown, haven't they? Yeah, I mean, it looks like President Xi is completely convinced that every time you get a single case of COVID, you've got a lockdown.
Well, that's the policy they've been pursuing since the beginning, so there's no change there then.
Well, no, but I mean, things have changed, haven't they? Like, COVID is nowhere near as dangerous. These regular versions now, after over 2 years of COVID, they have mutated to become actually quite good. I mean, people saying, for example, it's like a gift from God, Omicron. They were saying that at the end of last year. 2021, saying, well, actually, you know, if you can catch this, it gives you immunity, a degree of immunity anyway, to all kinds of COVID, and it's very undamaging, which is why we had Christmas this year. Anyway, so what do you make of what's been going on over in China?
Well, they're pursuing the same policy they pursued from the get-go, which is that they test and trace and try and get rid of any infection whatsoever. And don't forget, I think that the Chinese intelligence services have worked out a long time ago that COVID is a plandemic. It's a biological warfare agent developed by DARPA.
They're not overreacting.
Well, they're not taking any chances because it's warfare, Tony.
Well, today, they're not taking any chances with the freedoms of their people. They've just relocated entire neighbourhoods 100 miles away. So they're not saying that you're going to have to get in. It looks to me as if what the Chinese are doing is they're experimenting with how far they can push these sorts of measures on their population, almost as a sort of experiment, that they're experimenting on people. Why on earth is it necessary to move entire neighbourhoods 100 miles away?
Well, you better ask them that. I would point out, though, that the world is at war. The war began on 9/11. Biological warfare, the plandemic, is part of it. As we saw, Dilyana Gatasheva exposed the biolabs in the Ukraine. The Chinese and the Indians both picked up on that and said, we want a full investigation about these US biolabs.
People in Shanghai, for example, have had all sorts of trouble getting food.
Well, there's people in...
So that's okay. Well, that's okay then, is it?
Tony...
This is a voluntary thing that the government have decided to do. We're just going to say, oh, sorry, guys, you can't have any food.
Well, the fact is, Tony, that the Chinese are managing their affairs according to how they see fit. They see this as a war, as I do. The Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States of America had foreknowledge of the plandemic. And the people are going to say it's a plandemic. I totally agree with them. It's a biological warfare agent. The Russians and the Chinese know this. That's probably one of the reasons why the Russians decided to take their special military operation in Ukraine.
Actually, people in Shanghai, the city of 26 million people, was moving towards a more nuanced policy, but central government over in the Chinese Communist Party and President Xi, who must be obeyed, that imposed this much more strict lockdown onto Shanghai particularly. I mean, can you not see that perhaps an authoritarian government might wish to use COVID and these various restrictions to see what they can get away with by controlling their own people?
Well, in actual fact, of course, because Shanghai is such an important city, it's caused real economic problems inside China. And I understand from reading around the subject that other people in other parts of China are pretty annoyed with the Shanghai authorities for allowing the thing to get out of hand in the first place. But it's
just a virus.
Biological warfare agent,
Martin,
Tony.
No, you're going to start shouting again.
No, but you're just saying it's just a virus.
We're discussing it as
a biological warfare agent, and you're just saying it's just a virus.
It is just a virus. And I say
and
that
it just came from bats, didn't it? It just came from bats.
Okay, now you're being silly,
random.
Martin. You're just being silly.
It just
silly
randomly
now.
Came
Can
from bats.
Can you stop being silly, right? We're trying to talk about these poor people in China who are catching a variant of COVID which is not doing them any harm, and yet the Chinese government are using this as an excuse to close the country down, to take away all of their liberties, and actually to ship them into different parts of the country. It's a way over the top, and surely even you can see that.
No, because we're going to, as the war develops, Tony, the war we're all in, more and more of these measures are going to be adopted. What do you if they can carry out one kind of biological warfare attack, why can't they carry out more with more deadly viruses? And that's why you've got to have a plan to deal with that, which is the Chinese are doing. And of course, they haven't got mRNA vaccines. They've got their own vaccine developed by their public sector, just as Sputnik was developed by the public sector in Russia.
It's an authoritarian move.
It's an authoritarian state, Tony.
Yeah.
And they're at war with the West, which is run by the deep state who blew up the Twin Towers and have started World War III.
It sounds to me as if they're actually more at war with their own people.
No, Tony, all wars are like this. I'm afraid they are. They involve basically obeying orders and sticking to your officers, and then you've got some chance of winning.
These are families. They're not in the military. What are you talking about? They haven't got to do what their officers say.
Modern warfare is total warfare, Tony. Total warfare. Yeah. Everybody's involved, whether they like it or not.
Well, why is the Chinese... I mean, you know, surely... We spoke, didn't we, to Kees van der Peel, who you may or may not know quite well as a geopolitical analyst, an author, a writer about globalisation. He was saying, and I think made an extremely good case in his book, he's doing quite well in the United States at the moment, I think it's called Pandemic of Angst. And what he's saying is that authoritarian regimes around the world, and that, of course, includes the United States, are getting rather concerned that as they destroy democracy, as they crush democracy, the people might start to fight back. And it's quite clear that people in China are very much on the back foot. It's very difficult for them to fight back when they're being so restricted by their central government.
Yes, and if you actually did an opinion polls in China, you will see that 90% of the population support the government's policy.
Don't dare to vote against the government or to show anything.
When we go to war with China, you will find that the British will bottle it. They won't want to fight. The Chinese will want to fight. When our aircraft carrier gets to the South China Sea, the Chinese will cheer as they sink it. And we will decide that we don't really want to fight because we're not that interested in the South China Sea.
So I actually don't know if the Chinese people will want to fight.
We'll find out,
won't we? We shall see, because they will have been so bullied and badgered by their own
government. Yes, they're going to rise up and overthrow the Communist Party and bring in privatisation and factionalisation.
You see, all you're doing is you're putting up a straw man argument.
No, you're putting up a straw man argument saying that the virus is just a virus. We've discussed
just
week
a virus
after week.
Now. Martin, it wasn't at the start, but it certainly is now. It's extremely unlikely to kill you, and it's actually more likely to kill you, as we heard earlier, if you've had a booster jab.
I'm willing to discuss the booster jabs, because that's an mRNA vaccine produced by Western Big Pharma. That's part of the plandemic, absolutely. And of course, because a plandemic is actually about the virus itself in the first place, we are at war. Russia is at war with the West. China is at war with the West. The West has to lose.
Yes, but China is at war with its own people too.
The United States at war with their own people.
Earlier this week, hundreds in China were forcibly evacuated from their homes to allow for their homes to be disinfected. The restrictions take Shanghai's lockdown into its fifth week. City officials said all infected patients and close contacts will be transferred to government-run centralised quarantine. How lovely for them. Now, this smacks to me of obsession, of cleanliness obsession, almost like OCD that they've got on steroids at the top of the Communist Party. Only thing is, of course, there's no real need for this. Most of these people can either be treated with something like ivermectin if they're vulnerable, or just catch COVID, and it would be just like water off a duck's back. This Omicron variant is hardly going to touch them. So why on earth does the Chinese government, I put the final point to you, Martin, why is the Chinese government moving people across the country so they can disinfect their homes from a virus which is very unlikely to harm them at all now?
It may be that the Chinese intelligence services know rather more about what's going on in World War III than you do. I put that to you.
They're trying to discipline their population.
Yes, because that's what war does. It's a very disciplinary mechanism.
Are they training their population for World War III?
They're certainly talking them up. They're saying to their people, we are going to have to go to war, quite possibly. That's exactly what they're saying to their population. And what people in the West live in a cloud cuckoo land where they don't realise that that is actually where we're at.
Well, meanwhile, here, trying to defend some of our liberties, is a chap called Piers Corbyn. And I spoke to Piers Corbyn this week. He does a website called Stop New Normal, I think it's called, where he was actually driven into by Bob Blackman MP, who the police may be prosecuting for, it's kind of a road rage thing, really. They were doing a protest about the online safety bill, which used to be called the online harms bill, which basically is going to end free speech on the internet, this bill. So fantastic job. Piers is out there trying to stop this bill going through, campaigning about it, and he gets driven into for his pleasure.
I'm Piers Corbyn from Let the UK Live, and we were outside Parliament on Tuesday where we were protesting against the online so-called safety bill, which of course is to suppress freedom of speech on the internet. It takes away your rights on the internet because they can claim that anything is going to be potentially harming children or not safe for children or something, you see. Anyway, so we're standing there and the car comes along, so we block the car. A Tory MP for Harrow East, Bob Blackman. And this is in fact the car, number NG11, Bob. Vanity number plate. This is his car, and he drives us down. I'm standing right there, and he hits one person, grazes him slightly, but that was very very slight. And it was more substantial, and I've got a big bruise under my left knee when the right knee rammed against it. The police did nothing at first. They are taking it seriously now, and I've got an interview next week. And we have pictures of these bruises, which are substantial, and we've got all of it recorded on video. There was a case of an Extinction Rebellion protest where a woman she lightly sort of pushed the car against people who were sitting on the ground, and she was banned from driving. So, you know, if we've got any even-handed justice, Bob Blackman should be banned from driving.
So that's Piers Corbyn there. You know, the thing to do, isn't it, if you know, including with Extinction Rebellion, you know, if they're blocking a motorway or whatever, is you don't drive into them. If you want to, by all means, park your car, get out of the car and assist other motorists in moving them if you can. But this seems just like an appalling behaviour by this MP, Martin.
Yeah, I don't, whatever your views on or what Piers Corbyn thinks about anything, people shouldn't be driven into by cars, should they? It's pretty basic stuff.
Do you think he'll get justice? You know,
well, because he is such a high profile person, the police may feel that they're going to have to take some action on this case.
Well, actually, Julian Assange is quite a high profile person.
Well, indeed, yes, but I mean, the point is but that's on another level altogether, isn't it, of deep state perfidy.
And also, Piers also talked about this business he'd obviously picked up also on the latest statistics about the dangers of these boosters.
The recent figures coming out show that it's trebled. Risk of death is trebled. Well, you know, what is this jab? I mean, it is not a normal vaccination in any sense. It modifies your DNA and it appears to be creating spike protein. I mean, it is dangerous, deadly, and should be banned immediately. And I'm standing in the local council elections here to put that forward, among other things, because local councils are very responsible for propagating, you know, coercing and trying to argue and push people into taking these jabs, along with the local health authorities. Please join in where lettheuklive.com. Or also stopnewnormal.net, where we put up regular information about the events. We've got three candidates from Let London Live, which is obviously the same as Let the UK Live, but Let London Live in three parts of London. I'm in Southwark, we've got one in Camden and one in Hillingdon. So please get on there. You'll find that stopnewnormal.net carries quite a lot of that information, and of course actual action campaign events which we're doing on a daily basis.
Yeah, he puts out these he will email them to you, or I think maybe on Telegram or somewhere, but if you want, you can get, I think it's two or three times a week, Piers puts out a list of various things that are going on, almost all in London. This is really just so that if you're an activist in London, there's always something for people to get involved in. There's him again, Martin, picking up on this whole thing of the stats about the boosters. It's almost as if everything's moved on to Ukraine now. No one's really talking about COVID anymore in the news. You know, this is the way the news seems to operate quite a lot, is it gets out a whole load of headlines, say, for example, about Bucha and the massacre there being carried out by the Russians. And then when the evidence starts to appear, the news media have lost interest.
Well, obviously, there, that's a particularly egregious example, because it's shaping up that, in fact, it was the Ukrainian special forces that carried out the massacre. And, of course, Johnson and all these others have piled on immediately. They didn't have any information. They'd been just told by the Ukrainians that the Russians had done it. They just took that at face value and all waded in. But in actual fact, embarrassingly enough, it looks like the Ukrainians did it, and the evidence is piling up. Now, that's leaving aside other questions about, you know, COVID, etc. I mean, that's the way the news cycle works. But there is a link between COVID and what's going on in the Ukraine, which is the biological warfare labs, which is a key fact that people need to bear in mind.
We're talking about the local elections. We've got our referendum coming up the first Thursday in May here in Bristol about whether to keep the mayor system. What's your latest info on which way that's heading?
Well, I've no idea, really. I probably will vote to get rid of the mayor, but I'm not going to go out and campaign about it, because I don't think it's that important one way or another, and I've got other things to do.
What about, I mean, Bristol 24/7 have put an excellent little article out just talking to people on College Green, mostly students, I think, that they've been chatting with, and not so many older people. Actually, no, there's one, Mary Crowder, 66. Let's see what she's got to say. She talked about the imbalance of power wrapped up in having a mayor. A retired nurse from Windmill Hill said, "I don't agree with the system where the casting vote has the final say. That role can override anything the majority might want. Their ultimate say is everything. A committee system is a lot fairer and more representative and has to take in the majority. It's not just one person who could swing it in their direction. It seems to be most of these are youngsters, but most of them, Martin, also favouring this committee system over the mayor.
Yeah, well, I think the Greens are the coming force in Bristol politics, and their decision to go for changing the mayoral system will probably, at the ballot box, they will probably get what they want because they're the ones on the rise. And of course, the Labour Party officially is campaigning to keep the mayoral system because obviously Marvin Rees is a Labour mayor. But of course, as you know, there are differences of view in the Labour Party about whether the mayoral system's a good idea. So I think because there are no local elections taking place, the Labour vote won't turn out to vote for keeping the mayor. That's my assessment, that most people won't bother to vote. So the people who do go out to vote will be the ones motivated to get rid of the mayor, the Greens particularly, and it may well be that they will win. But of course, it's still quite possibly going to be a very low turnout.
Marcus Smith, 35-year-old creative, whatever that means, he says, I was really up for the mayor initially in the first referendum. I thought it would stop all the drama and infighting in the council and amongst councillors and to get some decisions made. But over the last 10 years, things have changed. We have a regional mayor, Dan Norris, too. I feel like the Bristol mayor has become redundant. He added processes may have happened slower than the old system, but more people felt involved and had input in the decisions. Well, there's something fundamental here, isn't there? The idea that, you know, if you have one person making all the decisions, that things will happen faster isn't necessarily better.
No, it isn't. And it's actually not consistent with the way Britain has been governed for a very long time, and we basically have a parliamentary system which is basically ruled by committee, and that is what we're used to. Having directly elected posts is an importation from the United States, and of course it's actually a foreign importation into our setup.
Well, it's elections, isn't it, all over, because France is doing its elections too. Martin, what do you make of the runoff between, same as last time, isn't it, between Macron and Le Pen?
Well, the French system is more flexible than our system because it is a first-past-the-post vote, but you get two rounds at every level. So what then tends to happen is you don't get the perverse scenario we get in this country where the Tories with 43% of the vote end up with an 80-seat majority. But you do get a situation where the left, mostly voted for Mélenchon, they have got now to decide to hold their noses and vote for Macron to keep Le Pen out or not to vote at all.
Anyway, so we're going to hear a bit of a contrast here now. I spoke to Eric Simon, who's a British French, and he was also one of the Yellow Vests over there. But before we hear from Eric, let's just hear the official coverage, because I was quite shocked that none of the coverage, well, very little, if any. I mean, I didn't obviously look at everything, but I had a pretty good look yesterday at the results of this debate that happened between Le Pen and Macron. I think it was on, Wednesday night, Thursday night? I'm not sure. Yeah, Wednesday night, I think. And just to see what the coverage was over here, and then to contrast that with what's really going on the ground in France. So in a way, what I'm trying to do is to test the London media. Are you actually relating genuinely what is concerning French people and what are the main issues in this debate? So let's have a listen now to the BBC report from Lucy Williamson.
After weeks of sparring from a distance, it's hand-to-hand combat. The first time in this election that Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen have fought face-to-face.
Bonsoir, Marine Le Pen.
Bonsoir.
With just two campaigning days left and a quarter of voters saying the debate will shape their decision, they've been waiting for this.
La présidente du régalien.
First up, the big one. Rising prices and spending power, Ms. Le Pen's favourite subject.
Rendre leur argent aux Français.
Her slogan, give the people their money back.
Ils sont impliqués d'ailleurs ensuite dans la guerre.
Mr. Macron lectures her on why her economic plans won't work.
Vous parlez à votre banquier quand vous parlez de la Russie.
And then goes for the jugular, her relationship with Russia.
Parce que vous dépendez du pouvoir russe et que vous dépendez de Monsieur Poutine.
You're dependent on Vladimir Putin, he says. When you speak to Russia, you speak to your banker.
Maintenant, ce que vous dites est faux plusieurs fois.
He knows perfectly well that what he's saying is false, Le Pen replies. He's hosted Putin in Versailles.
Monsieur Poutine en grande pompe à Versailles.
But what do voters make of it? Across the country in hands, voters from all sides, many still undecided, were watching the drama unfold.
We see a very different debate from 2017.
It appears that Marine Le Pen is much more well prepared than in 2017. She's very calm. She decided to not attack frontally the President Emmanuel Macron. And from my point of view, Emmanuel Macron seems a bit unstable.
So far, it's a very balanced debate. I'm biased, but the arguments are good and they may change my mind.
She's much better than last time, but she's still too weak in comparison with Macron. He's far stronger on every subject.
Marine Le Pen's job was to show that she was prepared for power. Mr. Macron's task was to show that she was not, without looking too arrogant and superior himself. Around 10 points separate them in the polls. 4 days separates one of them from power. Lucy Williamson, BBC News, Paris.
Let's talk to our correspondent Hugh Schofield, who's also in Paris. What is the instant verdict of voters in the polls that they take after these kind of debates?
Well, in general, I would say the verdict is that Macron came out ahead, but that Le Pen advanced her own cause because she didn't fail. I mean, she, if you remember, 5 years ago, she had this appalling...
At which point we fade down Hugh Schofield, who had absolutely nothing useful to say whatsoever. Martin, the coverage there really focusing on you know, who did well in the debate, etc. But they didn't really go much into the issues other than it, you know, this whole idea of give people their money back. I mean, that's going to be bound to be a vote winner, isn't it, over there?
Yeah, but what does it actually mean? You know, the fiscal problems of the state.
She relies on Russia, apparently. Russia is her banker. Who's his banker?
Well, I mean, he was a Rothschild's banker before he became the president. Marine Le Pen, Macron is using the crisis in the Ukraine to try and make Marine Le Pen look as if she's weak on Russia, etc., etc. And of course, traditionally, the French have had quite a constructive relationship with the Russians. De Gaulle, for example, saw them as a kind of counterweight to US hegemony in Europe. And of course, Le Pen is trying to capture some of that Gaullist sentiment to try and get people to vote for.
And have you seen The Day of the Jackal?
Of course, yes. I mean, De Gaulle was nearly assassinated several times by Western intelligence services.
So the CIA, I think.
And MI6. Yeah. Le Pen is saying that if she gets elected, she will take France out of the integrated structure of NATO, which they were taken back in before the attack on Libya by Sarkozy.
Well, there are some enormous issues in France that didn't get touched on at all in these reports I was watching yesterday. And one of them is this whole idea of the referenda that Marine Le Pen wants to bring in. So in a way, it's a way of her saying, I think, that the political class is so tainted that there's only puppets that are allowed to get into powerful political positions, that she wants to alter the French constitution so that whenever 500,000 people get half a million signatures on a specific issue, that it's legally binding, that the government must have a referendum on the subject, and it's legally binding that must influence, make policy like that. So she's saying, well, look, we as political leaders are having a great deal of difficulty, some getting bumped off. She's not saying this. This is me paraphrasing her, etc. So we would rather try and do some kind of direct democracy with the people through the Swiss form of referenda. Anyway, Eric talks about that. He also brings up something else which has been a big player in this French presidential election, and that is the quiet German-French military agreement, which effectively gives the Germans a seat on the UN Security Council via France. These things are, of course, massively important in international security, but generally not mentioned over here. So these are the sorts of things which are going through French people's minds as they get ready to vote this weekend on who's going to be their next president.
She is proposing to establish that would any kind of topic reach 500,000 signatories, okay, French people deciding to bring that very topic before, you know, would they decide to choose one topic, and if you got 500,000 signatories, then the state, the executive power, would organise a national referendum regarding this very topic. So For instance, it could be triggering Article 50 and leaving the European Union, for instance, because it has to be remembered that back in 2005, for instance, France decided by 55% not to join the European Union or the EU constitution. And it was through our so-called national representation, okay, which is the Assemblée Nationale, the lower room, and the Senate, our upper room, that it has been decided to absolutely disregard the decision of the French people, which has been obtained through the most direct democratic way, which is referendum, like you did with Brexit, which shows that politicians and representatives are not always on the side of the people. And so she wants to implement this, and she wants to implement that constitution. Change of constitution can only be implemented through referendum. So that is a major thing that could avoid, for instance, Macron to push France into a very dodgy Franco-German collaboration, which happened through the signing of the Aix-la-Chapelle Treaty back in 2019. So the Arendt Treaty is a treaty that has been signed by Merkel and Macron, through which Macron allows Germany and France to speak on a diplomatic and military matter as only one voice. So literally, this treaty allows Germany to have our seats, share our seats at the Security Council of the United Nations, and literally to have an option on anything that will be decided military by France.
Well, how is this business of Le Pen and her referenda going down? It sounds to me a little bit like they're borrowing this from the Swiss French, maybe.
That's exactly what it is. You know, it's what they call the Swiss have something called votation, which is like Swiss people are regularly requested to give their opinion on laws, on, you know, law proposal. And I think that's a very healthy way to exercise democracy.
So that's Eric Simon there, Martin. Interesting idea, isn't it, to enshrine this in the French Constitution, that actually any change in the French Constitution now would have to go through a referendum process, that the elected politicians, they're not allowed to change it, only the people can.
Well, I mean, she's obviously picked up this referendum proposal from the Yellow Vests movement, and she's hoping that the people who are in that movement will recognise that and vote for her. The problem she's going to have is that even if she wins the presidential election, she doesn't control the National Assembly, because you still have the elections to the National Assembly on a similar basis to presidential elections, but it leads to a situation where the Front National finds it very difficult to get anybody elected.
Yeah, but I mean, it might make a difference if she does get elected to the way that the result goes, and how, you know, they have a honeymoon period, don't they? Because I think, isn't it, in a couple of months' time, they have the national elections to the assemblies.
I'm not quite sure when the assembly elections are.
Yeah, I think it's not long after the presidential election.
The point is that
gives her a chance to sort of pitch to the public and say, well, hang on, you know, I want to do this and this,
yeah,
and now vote for your MP.
Well, the French constitution is actually quite fragile. It was only brought in 1958 when the army seized power from the then socialist government and put de Gaulle in power as a general. And then he double-crossed the OAS, the Army Organisation Army Secrète, which was opposed to withdrawing from Algeria, by going to withdraw from Algeria. So France, historically, has actually been a rather divided society, with potential for civil war. So with the global economic crisis that we're facing, and the huge marginalisation of the Muslim community in France, which is very big, the potential for very nasty developments is very much there.
I'm wondering what the betting is on, because that is William Hill always seemed to be the best people at predicting these things. Although they were saying that Rishi Sunak was going to do very well over here, but it ended up that that's very unlikely. So I'm just trying to check that this is. Oh no, this is from back in. This is pretty much up to date. Macron, it says, is basically 1-33, and Marine Le Pen 12-1. So they're saying it's going to be Macron.
Yeah, well, that's what you'd expect, because the left will probably not vote for Le Pen because of her Vichy past. Well, that, I mean, actually, basically, that we're gonna... National Front were in favour of the war in Algeria, and of course, her father, they were basically Pétainists. Well, so that it's very difficult for the left to vote for people who were pro-Pétain.
Well, I think so that was certainly
they
the
will
case...
probably vote for Macron to keep her out.
That was certainly the case last time, and in fact, that's exactly what Eric Simon talks in the second clip we've got from him about right now, which is Mélenchon. Basically, he is the modern version of Hollande, who ended up being a very,
Mélenchon is more left than Hollande.
No, it's the same party.
It's not the same party. Hollande was a socialist party. Mélenchon has got his own France Insoumise, which is his own party, Unbowed France. It's not the socialist party.
Isn't it? Right. But anyway, he's seen as similar to
He's a left-winger, but he's more left-wing than Hollande. Hollande was a more Blairite figure. Mélenchon is more like Corbyn.
But anyway, this is the point that Eric makes about Mélenchon, is that as soon as he realised he didn't stand a chance and he wasn't going to be in these runoffs this weekend, he said, you should do everything you can to keep Le Pen out. So...
yeah. That's the normal position.
Anyway,
of the French
so
left.
We see what Eric has to say about that position that he's taken there.
Ex-socialist prime minister who did not reach the second round in 2002, and there's a lot of these people who came from Trotskyist movement. Some of them as early as the 1968 French how can I say spring, you know, back in 1968. And ended up in being supportive of Macron in 2017. So that's quite not Trotskyist to move from, you know, the very left wing to become the supporter of a Rothschild banker, you know, not quite. So actually, Mélenchon has the exact profile of that kind of person, you know, like the very one of the last, how can I say, head of the Socialist Party in France, who only achieved a mere 2.17%. The last first round of the French election. If you see that these people were elected as the French president, like French President Hollande was elected as a French president from the Socialist Party, okay, he's the one that introduced Macron, and only 5 years later, you've got the French Socialist Party who only achieved 2.17%. This is how much disregarded this kind of fake left. It's like you have Keir Starmer in the UK, is now regarded by French voters. So all the votes moved on the left side from the Socialist Party to a bit more left-wing. I call him fake left-wing, Mélenchon, who talks left. But as soon as the result of the first round on the French election, released, within 10 minutes, you've got that guy, Mélenchon, who's, as I said before, whose program is 3/4 compatible with what Miss Le Pen says. So within 10 minutes, he said, okay, no vote for Miss Le Pen. And in a way, it's not been said like this because he doesn't dare to say vote Macron, but that's exactly what it means. Okay. He says, well, no, we need to block Miss Le Pen. However, whenever his program is 74% or 75% compatible with this one of Miss Le Pen. So what is this guy, what is this guy's game?
Well, he's talking there about Mélenchon, but he is a socialist. He's got his own party, apparently. Martin, the key thing here, I suppose, that Eric's talking about here is that it's almost like the guy's a stalking horse. So he knows he's not going to win, but he will garner some support, and he wants to use that support to back Macron.
Well, in actual fact, if you look at the voting in the first round, he got 20-something percent, Macron got 20-something percent, and Marine Le Pen got 20-something percent. So it's quite possible that...
Well, he's saying you got 2% there.
No,
so
that's the Socialist Party. The France Insoumise got more than that. The left.
Okay, so what I'm trying to get around to is something a bit more relevant, which is the lessons for the Labour Party here, that they could be just in the political wilderness.
Well, look, it's a different political system. So it doesn't work in the way ours works. So
we've
there
already,
are some comparisons,
had,
but there's quite a lot
well,
of differences.
Well, we've already had the warning signs, haven't we, with the Red War up in the north of England.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's just focus on France for a minute before we go on to Starmer and the Labour Party. I'm perfectly happy to discuss it, but they're not the same topic. In France, traditionally, Macron is regarded as the centre ground, okay? I mean, you can say what you like about
Tony Blair.
Well, indeed, that's right. And you've got the far right, Le Pen. Don't forget, no Muslims are going to vote for Le Pen. They won't. And that's why the left don't feel that they can vote for her either. And therefore, they will say you mustn't vote for Le Pen. Therefore, we've got to keep her out because the Muslim community, if Le Pen wins, you could have civil war in France. Because the Muslims will never vote for her and they will regard her as their enemy. Okay? That's the danger. And of course, it's the Algerian war that underpins all of this because most of the Muslims in France are people coming from Algeria. And of course, it nearly wrecked French democracy in the 1950s. And if Le Pen gets elected, the possibility of that kind of confrontation comes into view.
Anyway, so, what about the Labour Party then? Are there warning signs? I mean, we know it's different, Martin. We know it's different, but aren't there warning signs here for the left in the UK? As the Socialist Party has got 2.17% of the vote over in France now. It's basically Hollande was running the country, but he's just sold the left out, and so they've deserted him.
Yeah, well, what's happened is Mélenchon, who's like a more Corbynite figure, has taken the left's vote. Yeah. And there is a fairly strong left-wing tradition in France, just coming from 1968 and before, and those people want something a bit more red-blooded than you get in this country. For example, they've still got nationalised railways, nationalised energy industry, strong labour laws and all the rest of it. France is not
to be
like
fair,
Britain.
But to be fair, it's not totally nationalised, the energy industry.
No, but it's very different from the Thatcherised mess that we've got over here.
Haven't got anywhere near as far. But anyway, one of the interesting, because he was at the Yellow Vest, I thought I ought to ask Eric about whatever happened to them, because he's absolutely adamant that the left-wing anarchist Antifa movement was used by the state over in France to basically nobble the Yellow Vests. Anyway, he takes us through that his journey and the Yellow Vest's journey through being a major force for activism and then being slowly shut down by the French government using agents provocateurs.
I think, and these people are still at work at the very moment, is I think what killed more than COVID, the Yellow Vest movement, indeed COVID happened, but and this is something that is now worldwide known, it's called the Antifa movement, okay? Because at the beginning of the Yellow Vest, you had any type of French people. People, I think one of the big, one of the main topic that brought the Yellow Vest is that the French referendum that was stolen from the French people and most direct and democratic expression, which is referendum, back in 2005, was stolen by representative when Sarkozy, back in 2008, said, I'm going to go through MPs and Senate to actually acknowledge the Lisbon Treaty. It was not anymore the EU Constitution, it was the Lisbon Treaty. So I think the French people just really saw that as a main treason from the political class, because as just for Brexit, you had the left and the right all together to say, no, we stay in Europe. But it was very much just like the British, a very unpopular decision. So I think the Yellow Vest started from there. Then it linked up the fact that many pensioners could not even live with something like the very tiny pension of 800 euros or something like that when their rent is only 600 a month, you know. So you had pensioners, you had small business owners as well, on whose, how can I say, it's not tax evasion because it's legal, but for years and years, it could be the left and the right have just made tax evasion or legal evasion, let's say, like this. So they say tax optimization, okay, for the main big stock exchange company or the big international companies. So for a long time now in France, all these kind of loss in the state budget, because these people, you know, make gifts for the very powerful and rich people, had to be borne, can I say that? Yeah, borne by the middle class and the small business owner. So in the Yellow Vest movement, you had people from the right, you had people who were unemployed, you had people who were working, but, you know, due to the cost of living, you know, like could be energy, could be rent and all that, were just fed up on not having a life and just like literally carrying on, you know, and struggling for living. But very soon what, You know, so you had people from the right, far right, you had anything. Well, it's what is called now far right, which is not far right at all, as we've just described. But it was really a genuine popular movement. So very soon, and the government and the police allowed these people to get into the protest. And with one thing, I don't know if you know about that in the UK, it's called what they call the Black Bloc. You don't know who these people are, but strangely, they were just allowed to be, you know, as most of the protests in France were at the beginning of the Yellow Vests, were not even declared, or, you know, the protest was not kind of legal because nobody knew. It was just like text message at the last minute to move something like 200,000 people inside Paris quickly, like within half an hour. That was just amazing. And the same in the, you know, in the other parts of France. So very soon, what happened is, like, they said some people were kind of infiltrated without the Yellow Movement and promoted by the media as leaders. They were not leaders. I don't know who promoted them as leaders, but they talk as leaders. And indeed, the media show them as leaders. And then these leaders started to declare to the executive power where the protests will be and marching from one point to another. So from that moment on, the police and the state and Macron knew where to stop the people, where to block people, and within some kind of a square controlled by the police who could come in and come out, okay, started to gas people to create anger and fight. Indeed, because people just wanted to leave, not even to fight, but to leave this big square. And where this happened, I don't know how to call this, let's call it a loop, something like in the march, you know, during the marching process, strangely, that's exactly where the mainstream media were positioned on top of the building to show any, you know, violence that could erupt. They were begging for it. And when it was not happening, you had all these, you know, at some point in France or near the Champs-Élysées, you could not get near if you had just a yellow jacket on you, you know, high visibility jackets on you. Okay, and everyone was searched. It was just unbelievable. And now you tell me that out of the blue, you've got 200 or 400 people called Black Bloc or Antifa with, you know, with sticks and all that could get into the marching protest and then start to fight the police. So from time to time, these people got rid of the real leaders of or whoever did not suit the left-wingers or the Antifa, was called a fascist or labeled as a right-wing and blah, 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 kicked out of the protest. And these people, bit by bit, they took over the movement. So if you're a small business owner, you're not going to walk behind a 17-year-old disintegrated, can I say that, with no brain, people calling anti-fascist, anti-capitalist, and all that. You're not going to get decent, normal people behind these kind of, I wouldn't say lunatic, but just like brainwashed kids, you know. So time after time, the Yellow Jacket protest did not get very popular at all, you know. And then came the COVID as well. So from now, as there's no more COVID, for instance, and during this program, just after the first results of the presidential election, there's been a lot of people marching against Macron from the so-called far right, trying to reach out the electors of that guy called Mélenchon, you know, we just mentioned before. And you know what? As soon as people, or just like during the COVID protest, when, for instance, I'm from a place in France called Lyon. And for a place like Lyon, where there's not been much protesters, there was at least every Saturday, two or three different protests, one from the right, one from the left. And whenever by the, how can I say, the luck of the marching process, these two protests would gather and just join in one, you had out of the blue these Antifa thing erupting from nowhere and starting to punch one another. You know, and I was wondering, I said, who are these people working for? Obviously, they're working for the state.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all that the French state would be using agents provocateurs in demonstrations. I mean, they've done it for many, many years.
That's probably where the word comes from. It is French, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
This again, it echoes what Kees van der Peel, I haven't seen many people really saying this. This whole idea that, well, if we're going to have a great reset, we're going to have an oligarchy with a tiny number of people, a fascist international, if you want, ruling the planet, that we are going to have resistance. And so let's have some exercises on how to control and destroy that resistance.
Well, the deep state in the West has been trying to co-opt and destroy the opposition forever. It's not a new phenomenon. In the Strategia di Tensione in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s involved the deep state blowing things up and assassinating people, including police officers, and kidnapping the prime minister. So don't be surprised. That's what we're up against, folks.
Yes, democracy is being smashed, ladies and gentlemen.
If it ever existed.
Well, it did. Of course it did.
There's a question about that, isn't there?
Well, yes, Martin, I know you love the doom and gloom, but I think it's pretty clear in this country that it began with the Thatcher in the 1980s and the militarisation of the police. And I think, even if you go back to the 1960s and 70s, there just simply wasn't a need for a militarised police force. And come Thatcherism, for example, things like the miners' strike, in the 70s and in the 80s, this then became the norm. And that's where we are. So anyway, but back from, I think Eric did it. What do you think of Eric's job Eric did there on describing the way things have gone with the yellow vests?
Well, I think it's a fairly, it's obviously a personal view, but it's a very valid one. Well, any social movement has contradictions within it.
But I mean, there are quite clearly, they're very suspicious.
They can be exploited.
People like him are very suspicious when anyone with a yellow vest has all sorts of trouble getting in. And then when they get to the Champs-Élysées or wherever it is they are, they find there's a whole load of Antifa that have not had any checks at all. And there they are, 200 or 300 of them who are going to apparently lead the demonstration. They managed to get in without being checked by the police at all.
Well, the police have got a vested interest in the anti-fart bloc. Creating trouble, throwing petrol bombs, etc., to try and discredit the wider movement. It's been going on forever. Mm. It happened in Bristol with all those idiots attacking the police station. And I'm afraid that partly the state is to blame. They do it. They do have agents provocateurs, and they are trying to steer public opinion by manipulating it. But also, there's just the genuine contradictions. You've got some people in the Yellow Vest movement who are small business people. You've got anarchists and anti-capitalists, and these people are not necessarily the same. They're not necessarily going to agree.
Saying is it began to grow and grow and grow as a genuine movement. It started to find its feet, and then it got undermined. Anyway, so Steve Baker, let's bring back to British politics. Rebellions not only on the Champs-Élysées, but within the Conservative Party at the moment. Before we hear from Steve Baker speaking yesterday against the Prime Minister, Martin, saying basically the Prime Minister should go. This is the Tories, not Labour, saying this. Well, Labour are saying it too, although actually Starmer keeps changing his mind, doesn't he? He thinks that Boris shouldn't go because the war in Ukraine is far too important.
No, I think he's...
He's changed his mind back again now.
Well, he came at one stage, the SNP were calling for Johnson's resignation and Starmer was resisting it. I think he's now calling for the resignation of...
Again. He said, no, I actually am going to withdraw my call for Boris to resign. And now he's... Anyway, yes. The point being that the real activity seems to be going on in the Conservative Party with the former Brexit Secretary, Steve Baker. So let's have a listen to what he had to say yesterday.
Having watched what I would say is contrition, beautiful, marvellous contrition, isn't my sense of it, is it rather in a sense only lasted as long as it took to get out of the headmaster's study. And that's not good enough for me, and it's not good enough for my voters. I'm sorry, it's not. And I'm afraid I'm now in a position where I have to acknowledge that if the Prime Minister occupied any other office of senior responsibility, if he was a Secretary of State, if he was a Minister of State, a Parliamentary Undersecretary, a Permanent Secretary, a Director General, if he was a Chief Executive of a private company or a Board Director, he would be long gone. The reason that he is not long gone is because removing a sitting Prime Minister is an extremely grave matter, and goodness knows people will know I've had something to do with that too. It's an extremely grave matter, an extremely big decision, and it tends to untether history. And all of us should approach such things with reverence and awe and an awareness of the difficulty of doing it and the potential consequences. And that's why I've been tempted to forgive. But I have to say now, the possibility of that really, for me, has gone. I have to say, I'm sorry, that for not obeying the letter and the spirit, and I think we have heard that the Prime Minister did know what the letter was, the Prime Minister now should be long gone. Yeah. Madam Deputy Speaker, I'll certainly vote for this motion, but really, the Prime Minister should just know the gig's up.
Isn't this a certain amount of posturing going on here within the Tory party, or is he just desperate to make sure he pleases his voters, which of course is what MPs should be there to do?
Yeah, I think I was interested to see that they decided not to oppose the reference to the Standards Committee, and therefore they gave the Tories a free vote, and they all decided that they would refer into the Standards Committee. So that was unanimous across the House. And of course, the Standards Committee, if it finds him guilty of lying to Parliament, the ministerial code is absolutely clear, he has to resign. And of course, the thing about Boris Johnson is he ain't gonna, even if they say he should. So it's gonna be interesting, isn't it?
Well, it's do you think when someone like Steve Baker there says, I think you should resign, I think you should resign, my main question to you was, is this something he's saying for his constituents, or do you think he really, really means it? Does he want him out? And maybe, for example, he and David Davis and the rest have got another candidate they want to take over from Boris, and they think they can do it.
I think part of the problem for the Tory party is it's not clear who they would want to replace Johnson. So, and of course, whoever they choose, there's going to be other people, you know, other people who won't like what they've chosen.
How about the lovely Liz Truss?
Well, I mean, there are plenty of people who've got their eye on the top job. I'm constantly astonished by how many very, very mediocre Tory backbenchers think they ought to be Prime Minister. That, you know, if there's any contest, they will all be huffing and puffing to get their hats into the ring. I think it's very...
Someone like David Davis stands a chance, though, doesn't he?
Not really.
No?
No. I think the main runners, as we know, are Rishi Sunak, Liz Truss.
Well, this is what William Hill are on, but now that Rishi Sunak has his approval rating has gone right down.
Well, that's
down
right.
Over
that's
the last
another. That's a
Liz
problem
Truss,
for the Tories.
I'd love to see her in some sort of debate with almost anybody. Manage to keep her head above the surface of the water. I mean, you know, neither of these two are really credible anymore.
No, I mean, I don't want a Tory government on 43% of the vote with an 80-seat majority at all.
I
don't want any of them running the country.
Well, we know that, Martin, but, you know, we have to be realistic that it's not going to be Keir Starmer.
Well, it might be after a general election.
Yes, okay. I even doubt that, actually. I think, in a way, that the powers that be have made sure Starmer's in charge to give the Tory party the best chance of winning the next general election.
I think that... But one of the problems for the Labour Party is that the Tories are going to change the electoral boundaries and reduce the...
They always do this, don't they?
Well, that's right. So they're gerrymandering away. And they're going to change the electoral boundaries on the basis of the existing electoral rolls, which we know in inner city areas are completely... You know, loads of people aren't registered. So the boundaries will, in fact, mean that poorer people in inner city areas will be disadvantaged. So even under the first past the post system with a split vote on the left and all the rest of it, the Tories could hope to win a general election. Because though they won't get 50% of the vote. I mean, whoever wins the French election on Sunday will definitely get 50% of the vote. That's not the case in our country. And I think the Tory party have got itself into it. I mean, they basically bet the farm on Boris Johnson. And of course, their own voters, the core voters in the Tory core seats are all saying he's got to go. And that's the problem for him, is that the core Tory vote have decided that he's a wrong'un.
Well, the US deep state is having a bit of a party this week because Julian Assange is moving one step closer to US extradition. As Boris bends over, no, sorry, that's not what the headline says. It says, as magistrates issue an order, leaving it down to Priti Patel to rubber stamp the decision. But WikiLeaks founder can still appeal. So Westminster Magistrates Court issued a formal order. This is amazing. It's like Gradgrind versus Gradgrind, isn't it? Dickens, going on and on and on this case, even though he's not actually committed any crime. Very much like the whole situation with the attempt to get him for an alleged rape in Sweden, where even the Swedish authorities had not issued charges against him. There wasn't enough evidence. You know, the whole thing is really very surreal. At Westminster Magistrates Court has issued a formal order for Assange's US extradition. The Home Secretary, Priti Patel, will now have to rubber stamp the extradition of WikiLeaks founder. Assange's supporters say they have a month to make representations to Priti Patel, and it comes after the Supreme Court rejected the plea. This is a few weeks ago when we spoke to John Shipton, Julian's dad, as we will, I'm sure, again, to allow him to appeal to the High Court. No, not allowed. Assange's legal team say there are other parts of the appeal still left. So this is, yeah, I mean, it's the latest, he's saying, you know, the piece of paper now exists saying Julian Assange is going to go to the United States. This is what he was warning of right along. This man was absolutely on the money for the last, 12 years or so. The Americans want me in their prisons, and British are just simply going along with it.
Well, yes, and it's a shocking travesty, isn't it, the whole thing. Incidentally, I think it was Jaundice versus Jaundice in Dickens.
Jandice versus Jandice.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
That's
right. Gradgrind was in Hard Times.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're
he
right.
He was the school teacher.
Yes. Okay.
So just, you know, minor point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is appalling, and you know, we got the right, you know, the cheek to lecture other countries on freedom of speech. It's absurd.
So is he going or not?
Well, hopefully not. But
how does Bleak House wind up? How does that case finish?
I can't remember.
Jandice and Jandice.
I can't remember. Anyway, the point is that, I mean, it's, obviously that's, you know, these are not really the point, are they? Well, if he goes, I think it could be that he'll get a spectacular trial in the US and then he will get to answer his accusers. Who knows? I mean, the whole thing, he shouldn't be in prison at all. He's committed no crime in British law. And the Espionage Act of the United States, which has got extraterritorial jurisdiction, anybody in the world can be charged with treason to the United States. Absolutely ridiculous.
Julian Assange's supporters include the former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn and members of Amnesty International. They held a protest outside the court in the build-up to the hearing. The United Nations have had things to say about this too. We are now becoming a pariah state around the world in terms of free press and human rights.
Yes, and you'd have thought that the embarrassment of that, but when you're supposedly aligning with the United States to deal with authoritarian regimes and we're going to be beacons of democracy, you'd have thought that the hypocrisy of it all would eventually overwhelm people. But as you can see, it's only the political fringe, you know, the Corbynite left of the Labour Party, who are prepared to stick their necks out and say this is wrong. And Keir Starmer, who is a senior lawyer, has seen fit to say nothing, which is quite extraordinary if you think about it.
So, of course, Julian is now married to Stella Morris, and Vivienne Westwood designed her wedding dress, which looks rather nice if people would like to look it up. Married he is now.
A lot of people
haven't even heard this. I've spoken to several people. Oh, is he married? I didn't know about that.
Well, I mean, basically, it's all happening in plain sight, but as you know, the vast majority of the mainstream media ignore it. And, people have just, he's in prison, he must have done something. You know, it's pretty pathetic, actually. I mean, some people don't deserve to be free. If you're not prepared to stand up and say Julian Assange should be released from prison, maybe you deserve to be tyrannised over.
Perhaps. Online safety bill, used to be called the online harms bill when I first started looking at it must be 3 years ago. This is people have been talking about this which is why, by the way, earlier we heard from Piers Corbyn, why he was outside the House of Commons getting himself run over for us, is this online safety bill. It is likely to lead to, some people are saying it's going to be the end of free speech online.
Well, it quite clearly might, mightn't it? We can see which direction everything is going in. There's far more control. You know, they're attempting to control what we can say and who we can say it to. I mean, they've been doing it forever, but they're intensifying their efforts.
Well, if our listeners aren't following Big Brother Watch, please do, not only for the lovely Silky Carlo, who runs it, who was with us at the Bilderberg conference in Watford in 2013, doing her best to manipulate the press coverage. I don't know how well she did at that. But anyhow, Big Brother Watch have put out a little statement about the online safety bill. They're doing a superb job, this lot. Because what they're doing is they're trying to work, what are the key points? Let's just make sure that people know what the key points in this bill are, because many of the articles about it are actually, obfuscate the key issues. So anyway, let's have a listen to Big Brother Watch's little briefing, very short one, on the online safety bill.
Anti-free speech legislation is coming. It threatens our free expression, our right to privacy, and even an open internet. So what is the online safety bill, and why should we be worried? 1. Private Silicon Valley policing.
Believe it or not, there are voices off who would rather this bill didn't happen.
The online safety bill sees the state command Silicon Valley to act as private police. This means that the likes of Facebook will have to make determinations on what is and isn't illegal on their platforms. This undermines due process and the rule of law. Crime online needs to be dealt with, but through the police and the courts, not tech executives. 2. Threat to freedom of expression. The government have created a new category of online free speech which they deem to be harmful. What constitutes harmful speech is whatever the government of the day says it is. The bill is going to cause platforms to censor and take down more online expression than ever before. It will rip up hundreds of years of British free speech standards. 3. Political control. The government plan to appoint Ofcom as their new online speech regulator. Ofcom will be given the powers to punish platforms who don't police their sites strictly enough. But the government have given themselves powers to influence Ofcom and set the standards for what should and shouldn't be allowed on the web. This is a dangerous precedent and could easily lead to political censorship online. 4. Attacks on privacy. The online safety bill will see the state force platforms to use new surveillance technology to scan everything that we post on their sites. This is a chilling development. But if that wasn't enough, the bill will also force platforms to scan our private messages and seeks to bring in new ID for access systems by using age verification technology. Privacy and security are mutually reinforcing concepts, and many people need privacy to keep themselves safe. The bill must not undermine this fundamental right. 5, failure to tackle surveillance capitalism. At the heart of social media companies' business models is the mass commodification of users' sheer online presence. Mass corporate surveillance techniques are used to pry over individuals' every move online. These data-gathering practices feed algorithms that cater content to users, particularly that which is sensational, in order to keep us online, gather more data, sell more products, and continue this cycle. By making Silicon Valley's practices state-backed, this entire system of what has become known as surveillance capitalism will become entrenched. We have to push for radical changes to the bill because our freedom online is at stake. So sign our petition to save free speech online and join us today.
Well, I don't often say this, but I think it's time to write to your MP, probably an old-fashioned snail mail, maybe an email, who cares, but to demand that they reply. And we're talking about here about, potentially, well, there's three specific people to write to. One is obviously Boris and Priti Patel over Julian Assange, and then also Nadine Dorries over this online safety bill. The worst thing about it, to my mind, Martin, is having these private companies, the social media companies, basically deciding what is safe to put on the internet and what isn't. I've just had in a way, maybe what they're doing with this is just catching up with the fact that the social media companies are doing this anyway. I've had a 1-month Facebook ban, which was imposed on me by artificial intelligence and electronically yesterday for posting a picture of a guy. It was just a photograph of a guy on the Wailing Wall who appeared to have tattoos, one of which included a swastika. Now, the idea is that is because I'm supporting him. Now, that's what the artificial intelligence bot at Facebook decided, maybe. Actually, it could quite easily be that, I get blacklisted by Facebook and they're just looking for any old excuse. You don't get any kind of proper appeal. The obvious thing to do is just to leave Facebook and go to VK.com, which is a Russian version of basically the same sort of thing, where you can do similar stuff. And in fact, you're fine. There's a load of us over on VK.com already. People are starting to flood across there because Facebook is now starting to ban people willy-nilly. But anyway, back to the online safety bill. This, again, it's like the golden age of the internet is coming to an end. It's a bit like sort of 60s, 70s television slowly being crushed in the 1980s and early 90s. The same is happening to the internet. The idea of free speech isn't really of much interest to the oligarchy.
It's true. They are definitely trying to control narratives in all sorts of different ways. But I still have my doubts about whether they've really, you know, you can say, for example, that you are banning RT. RT has been banned, but of course I can get it on my computer by just putting RT International.
Yes, but if you notice the difference in the figures of the audience, have
well,
you noticed
course,
that?
Yes, of course. It will, that's
it's
the
gone from millions down to something like 700.
Well, I don't know what the figures are at the moment, but
well,
yes.
We can try it if you
yeah,
want.
Yeah, I mean, but the point is, yeah, that's why they do it. But on the other hand, if you want to, I mean, what's important for an organisation like RT is that you just get people flicking through the channels and they may just light on it and have and decide to watch it. And of course, you can pick up quite a lot of viewers like that. And of course, by banning it, you know, people have got to actually go out of their way to find it if they want to find it.
So they've got about 560 viewers right now on Odyssey, which is where you can find RT. You go to odyssey.com, that's odyssey.com/@RT:FD, whatever that means, feed, I suppose that is. Or you just go into odyssey.com and do a search for RT, and that is sitting there. They do quite early evening bulletins, live early evening bulletins.
Pro-Russian, it looks like it's, and accused him of collaborating.
Sorry, it's just that it just started firing up there. But there they are. And on this channel, by the way, if you're listening during the week, you will pick up Sputnik, which is in English, with the Dave Bazanko, our sound engineer, the whiz kid, has managed to make it so that most of the time when we're off air, we do repeats twice a day of this program. But when we're off air, you will most likely pick up the English language satellite. It was a satellite, wasn't it? Sputnik. So anyway, Martin, the point here being, I suppose, that the RT is not doing anywhere near as well as it could do, because people are generally not watching it.
Well, I mean, that's the reason why they'll have banned it. But of course, in other parts of the world, it hasn't been banned and people can still access it. And ultimately, of course, what makes me laugh is that you've got outside the MI6 headquarters, they're flying the Ukrainian flag, and you can be certain that they at least will be watching it. Because that's what they do as part of their, you know, keeping an eye on the Russians.
Anyway, back to Silky and the Big Brother watch. The other thing which is going to be, they're going to be implementing using this, it almost seems as if Bill Gates has written this bill, is this digital ID that you'll use to go when you're going online to, so you can verify your age and everything. Digital ID.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, yes. I mean, all of these developments are very worrying, and it's all moving ahead of pace as we move into the biggest capitalist crisis of the century.
Yeah, self-inflicted crisis. That's the thing that makes it funniest, is that all these sanctions that the West has imposed on Russia have actually backfired spectacularly, but they don't seem to care.
Well, I think that's because they know that even if there hadn't been sanctions on Russia, the global capitalist system is in a very, very ropey state. And of course, you know, at some point, all of these things begin to interact. So you've got the security situation interacting with the economic situation, the global society is in massive crisis.
So final item before the break is... we'll be looking at, I think, an amazing article by Will Banyan. He runs something called conspiracyarchive.com, which is looking at, the headline is The Savile Affair Redux, When David Met Jimmy at Breakfast Time. Anyway, so Will Bannion is basically proven now, because it popped up in this Netflix documentary about Jimmy Savile, some shots with David Icke. But it turns out that David Icke, for the last 10 years, has been trumpeting that, oh, he never met Jimmy Savile through the BBC. But there he is, actually sitting with him and actually interviewing him. In amongst the many disturbing revelations, Will says, in Netflix's recent two-part documentary series Jimmy Savile, A British Horror Story, keen viewers would also have caught a brief glimpse of the creepy Savile sitting next to a youthful, permed David Icke on the set of the BBC programme Breakfast Time. The brief footage cropped up during a segment focusing on Breakfast Time's anchor, Selina Scott, who was recalling her uncomfortable encounters with Savile on that programme in the 1980s. The reaction of a number of viewers, though, was to focus on the sheer bizarreness of Savile Icke and the disgraced Frank Boff, all sharing the same couch with Scott. Missing from this bemused commentary was recognition that David Icke had once denied that an encounter like this ever took place. Looking beyond the grim humour of the moment, this few seconds of footage refuted one of the pillars of Icke's claims to being both ignorant of and separate from Savile whilst at the BBC. And there he is, Martin, sitting right next to him. He must have forgotten that he'd ever interviewed him.
Well, I mean, that's a matter of it. He's got to decide whether he believes he did meet him or not. But obviously he did. Lots of people did. You can imagine Jimmy Savile was all over the BBC for years. And so amazing, anybody working there is likely to run into it.
David Icke has got to be seen with his perm. Absolutely amazing. And thanks to the Netflix documentary about Jimmy Savile, we now know for certain that they did indeed meet at the BBC on Breakfast Time. Maybe it only happened that single time, although Savile apparently made quite a few appearances on that programme, raising the possibility of more couch-sharing moments. But contrary to the bold declaration Icke made in 2012, he and Savile did meet at the BBC in the 1980s. And as Will Bannion says, this revelation exposes yet again why Icke is an unreliable and untrustworthy source.
Well, I mean, I don't think we need to know that he met Jimmy Savile to conclude that he's an untrustworthy source. Because
I think maybe you just missed the point, because Icke has made it absolutely clear, I never met Jimmy Savile at the BBC, and here we've got shots of him on set in the middle of a live programme.
Yeah, really. Well, okay, so David Icke may have deliberately lied about that, but of course David Icke has also said a lot of other things, like that the moon is actually a spaceship, which I think is rather more revealing of his non-analysis, which he manages to... he's quite a successful internet influencer, and there he is.
So what do you make of Icke? Because he's got a tremendous number of followers. It's almost like a kind of guru-like following.
Well, obviously, from my mainstream political intelligence analysis point of view, his prognostications are annoying, because the fact that he talks about 9/11, yes, good, but then he wants to talk about the moon being a spaceship in the same breath. That's not
hollow, a hollow spaceship made of metal. How do you know it isn't, Martin?
Well, I just say that I did O level physics, and if it was a hollow spaceship, the Earth would have a role. It stabilizes the Earth's orbit.
Oh, I'm sucking you in here, aren't I?
Yes, because it's actually a big piece of rock.
Okay, so yeah, but you see, what I say is anything that you can't see right in front of your nose, like the moon or a vapor trail of an aircraft up in the sky, you can make up any kind of story about it and suck people into it.
I am of the opinion, we talked earlier about agent provocateurs. There is actually real conspiracies going on within the deep state. And one of the things they do is they have loads and loads of false, fake conspiracies out there, because that's a way of making it all sound a bit cookie, blah, 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 blah. Whereas, this is where people need to get real. I mean, you saw Alex Jones, who was a marginal figure, but eventually became quite prominent in the Trump campaign. And he's basically saying, that 9/11 was an inside job, which it was. But he's also saying lots of other stuff. I mean, if 9/11 was an inside job, voting for Trump ain't going to solve the problem, is it? We're going to have to take down the deep state. And that's the reality. And that means possibly what's happening in the Ukraine is that the Russians have taken the bait.
Well, this is, well, okay, but one other thing, we're going to be talking about Ukraine in a minute, Martin, but maybe, I mean, I think it was the Saker that said, well, actually, they've not just taken on the Nazis in Ukraine, they've taken on the Nazis all around the world, the Russians.
That's right. This is the moment. But after 9/11, it was quite obvious that at some point there was going to be a world war, and the Russians have bided their time, and the moment has come.
Come around to mourn for Grandad, don't dress up in black, cause although me Grandad's dead and buried, odds on he'll be back, yes. Although they stuffed him in a coffin and read out the will, and although he's 6 foot deep in darkness, he'll never lie still. He's made of sterner stuff, he's not dead enough. Angels, saints and seraphim, please, please will you try to keep an eye on him. On his 90th birthday, Grandad went down for a drink. Now, me Grandad is a rabid dipso with a throat like a sink. He drank himself toward the skyline, his friends to the floor, just to prove how fit he was for boozing. for 90 years more. Your pearly gates he'll climb when it's opening time. Angels, saints and seraphim, you'll find it hard to keep a guard on him. They brought him home upon a handcart with his legs in the air. He was singing Rule Britannia backwards in his underwear. He challenged all the county police force to a fight right away. Then he offered to put the ladies' union in the family way. Your crystal domes will shake when he makes his break. Angels, saints and seraphim, he'll give you the slip, so get a grip on him. The doctor lifted up an eyelid and pronounced him gone, but to judge from Grandad's finger signals, the doctor was wrong. They dressed him in his Sunday night shirt, they combed out his hair, but they couldn't get me Grandad's boots off, he'd need them up there. Your silken wings he'll shed, he will paint paradise red. Angels, saints and seraphim, please, please don't expect that much respect from him. Even at the solemn moment, he wouldn't behave, for I heard him whistling in his coffin on his way to the grave. He took off toward the New Jerusalem with his pinch of salt. I distinctly heard him flatulating in his marble vault. Your candles will be dimmed when he gets the wind. Angels, saints and seraphim, although he's old, although he's cold, keep a tight hold on him.
So that's Jake Thackeray from 1972 with Grandad. And before that, you heard The Beauty of the Earth. Terrific hymn there, sung by the Cambridge Singers. And welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Part two, we're obviously focusing on Ukraine as we do every week, Martin, and we're going to go plunge straight in by hearing from Scott Ritter. Do you want to just say something? Because, I mean, he does introduce himself in the longer clip, which you can hear up on our show page, as you can Eric Martin, and you just heard in part one, longer clips from both of those, or longer interviews with both of those, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight. But Scott really is quite a unique figure, and he's absolutely uniquely able to make comments on this, but he's not used at all by the Western press because apparently he's a paedophile.
Well, that's just a load of rubbish, as you know. Well, I mean, he was a weapons inspector in Iraq, and he basically was telling the... I mean, when he came to speak at Bristol University, he said, well, I was a UN weapons inspector. I was, in fact, working for the CIA. I was lying when I said I was an independent UN weapons inspector. I was working for the CIA. And I was telling the CIA and the authorities in the US there are no weapons of mass destruction. And they kept saying, well, keep going back and having another look. I said, well, we've already looked. There isn't anything. But eventually he was saying, well, I just got loads and loads of helicopters and stuff. I'll go and have another look. Well, you know, you'll have to give me another few million pounds to go and have another look. But we know for a fact that there ain't any.
Well,
and of course, he's become a very, very trenchant critic of US policy. And of course, with his military background, he understands far more about what's going on in Ukraine than many other people.
He does. He understands it very well. And he doesn't side with Russia either. He's just very critical of the US for all sorts of very good reasons. He's not congratulating the Russians in any way for invading. He's just explaining why they've done it and how he predicted that they would do it, etc. But he starts here by telling me and us what he makes of the sinking of the Moskva. This is disguided missile cruiser, which was sunk last week. And, of course, it does take a few days for the bits and pieces of info to come out about it. One of the main things I wanted to know from him, Martin, is, was the West, was NATO involved in this? And, of course, he said, well, almost certainly yes, from a command and control intelligence point of view. And then also the idea that potentially there might be nuclear weapons on board the ship. Have you heard that talked about? And, you know, if that's gone to the bottom of the sea, then that's potentially very dangerous, isn't it? If you've got nuclear waste leaking out of a wreck at the bottom of the Black Sea.
Yeah, I understand it's in between 50 and 100 metres of water. And they get, they have to go down there and strip out anything that's they don't want anybody else to have or that's potentially dangerous.
I mean, questions like I've just raised don't get raised over here. Did NATO do it, you know? Is this now a nuclear disaster zone?
Well, Tobias Elwood, if you know who he is, on the Commons Defence Committee, Tory MP, he is calling for Britain to send a naval force to the Black Sea to support the Ukrainians in Odessa.
Which is absolutely
bizarre, because of course the Turks have said that we're not going to allow any warships through the Bosporus. How would they get there?
Maybe they'd get through the Dutch. Did they make it through the Dardanelles?
Well, they can't make it through the Dardanelles because the Turks have already said we're not letting you bring your ship. You know, the only ships that are allowed.
You know what they could do is bring a submarine through. Then the Turks wouldn't even know.
The point is, the level of unreality of the debate is absolutely extraordinary. There is absolutely no way that the British or anybody else, I mean, if the Americans decided they wanted to, that they can send a naval task force to the Black Sea.
So the Turks
won't let them through, and B, even if they got there, there would be a turkey shoot.
So the Russians have got all their top equipment
lined up along the coast there, and they will just sink the lot.
People at the top of the British in military are fantasists.
Well, I mean, Tobias Elwood is ex-military, but he's a politician.
It's the politicians that tell the military what to do.
Well, no, in theory, yes. But in practice, obviously, the military has its own ideas.
Okay,
the fact is that it's just ridiculous, impractical. Why even discuss it? Because it's so impractical, it's hardly worth talking about.
Rather than Tobias Elwood or one of these fantasists, let's have a listen to Scott Ritter now talking about the sinking of the Moskva, particularly last week, this guided missile cruiser, the flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet.
Well, my name is Scott Ritter. I'm a former military intelligence officer. I served in the United States Marine Corps. I've done arms control inspections, both in the former Soviet Union and in Iraq. And I participated in military operations against Iraq during Operation Desert Storm in 1990-1991. When it comes to the sinking of the Moskva, the flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, my assessment is that it was struck by two Ukrainian Neptune coastal defense systems. It sustained fatal damage, and it was sunk with considerable loss of life on the part of the Russian Navy. It's in Russia's interest not to broadcast the details of this. First and foremost, because Russia needs to figure out how the Ukrainians managed to hit their flagship with two coastal defense missiles. If Russia acknowledges that this indeed happened, it confirms a Ukrainian capability. So long as Russia denies this, Ukraine can't be 100% certain that their missiles struck the ship, although I'm pretty sure the Ukrainians and anybody who was monitoring this attack knows exactly what happened. The other thing is the morale issue. To lose the flagship is a big deal, and to have loss of life that probably amounts to several hundred sailors. Russia claims to have gotten everybody off the ship, but when one examines the photograph or the video of the ship's crew, there's only about one quarter of the sailors that one would expect to be present if everybody got off the ship. So I think Russia is suppressing the damage for security reasons and for morale reasons. And at some point in time, Russia will have to be will have to come forward with all the details. But I think that will take place after Russia achieves victory on the ground in Ukraine, not before. I do believe that the U.S. Navy and other U.S. Intelligence collection capabilities were involved. I don't think the Ukrainians could have done this without intelligence support from the United States. Ukraine had to be able to find a gap in Russian defenses. Ukraine doesn't have the intelligence collection capability to make that determination. The United States has been monitoring the Russian fleet since prior to this conflict, and the United States is fully aware of the various defensive capabilities of the Moskva and any ships that were operating in its vicinity, and I believe we're able to find a seam in these defenses, which it communicated to the Ukrainians, who were able to employ their systems to great effect. I will not accept at all any notion of the United States being involved in this attack. That's just absurd on the face of it. The United States gains absolutely nothing by doing this and risks everything. It's an act of war, one that, you know, that there's just literally no, not only legal justification, but there's no political justification. There's no way anybody can explain to me how Joe Biden, how the United States, how NATO benefits from risking World War III just to sink an old Soviet area cruiser. I firmly believe, given the de-escalation procedures that have been put in place for some time, that nuclear weapons were taken off the Moskva years ago and are in storage. The Moskva is not a ship that's preparing to engage in conflict with NATO. It's a ship supporting military operations against Ukraine, and therefore the totality of its weapons package will be configured to support a conventional war. I don't believe there are any nuclear weapons on the Moskva. I believe the cruise missiles that they had on board were configured conventionally and indeed have been used conventionally. The Moskva has participated in the bombardment of targets in Ukraine, and that's not something you would do if there were nuclear weapons on board. When you have a ship that has nuclear weapons, it becomes a strategic asset, not a operational or tactical asset. So again, I reject the notion that there were nuclear weapons on board the Moskva. There's no doctrinal or operational or tactical reason for these weapons to exist. And therefore, I don't believe there's a nuclear threat to the Black Sea that would be brought about by loose Russian nuclear weapons lying on the seafloor of the Black Sea.
Well, we've also seen a realignment. The Russians have announced it. The Western press has announced it too, of the actual way that the battle is going in the east of Ukraine, particularly. Can you just explain what the Russians are up to there? Because they seem to have pulled out of certain areas and now concentrating their troops for a different kind of operation. Can you just take us through that transition, please, Scott?
Russia said all along that their primary objective in this, one of their primary military objectives, purely military objectives, was the liberation of Donetsk and Lugansk, the two newly independent republics that constitute the Donbas region. The Ukrainians have deployed their finest fighting force. That's not me saying this. President Zelensky was just on over the weekend saying the troops that are deployed in eastern Ukraine are the finest in Ukrainian armed forces. This is 60, maybe 80,000 of these Ukrainian troops that are in eastern Ukraine right now, opposite Donetsk and Lugansk. But to destroy these, if Russia focused solely on the engagement and disruption of these units, destruction of these units in the opening phases of the campaign, Ukraine is a military of 260,000 professional troops, the second largest military in Europe, highly trained, highly well-led, well-equipped, with upwards of 400,000 reserves and National Guard units that can be rapidly mobilized. If they've got 60 to 80,000 of them deployed in eastern Ukraine, that leaves, you do the math, that leaves about 180 to 200,000 regular troops and upwards of 400,000 reserves that could be brought to bear in response to any Russian campaign solely focused on the destruction of these forces. This would be a battle that would be disadvantaged to the Russians. So phase one of Russia's operations appeared to be shaping the battlefield to their advantage. This involved a what I believe is a feint, a deception attack on an axis leading out of Belarus towards Kiev that froze considerable numbers of Ukrainian forces in place around Kiev and prompted Ukraine to divert reinforcements from Western Ukraine to Kiev instead of sending them to the east. It involved amphibious feints off the coast of Odessa that froze troops there, again, requiring reinforcement. These troops couldn't be used to be sent to eastern Ukraine. And then it required some supporting operations in the south and out of Russia to create a land bridge connecting Crimea with mainland Russia that would allow for the operational maneuver of their troops, along a front that Russia now had total control of. This was phase one. It also included strategic air operations designed to degrade Ukrainian command and control, weapons storage, logistics, fuel, as well as to blow up, the Ukrainian military itself. Of the 24 brigades that Ukraine had at the beginning of this war, Russia has said that all 24 have been degraded to the point that they're no longer capable of carrying out coordinated large-scale combined arms operations. That means that they're fighting bravely at the battalion level, but they're not able to carry out brigade or above-level maneuvering. That was phase one. Now, phase two was to disengage from the Kiev feint and redeploy those troops, further east towards Kharkiv to free up troops from the investiture of Mariupol and start pushing from the south with the goal of doing a double envelopment to trap these 60 to 80,000 Ukrainian troops in a giant cauldron reminiscent of some of the battles from the Second World War where the Soviet army trapped Germans, most famously in Stalingrad, but there were other battles as well. And I think that's what phase two is about. Phase two is about the destruction of the bulk of Ukraine's finest fighting forces in the Donbas. And when this phase is finished, so too is the Ukrainian military and so too is the Ukrainian government. It'll be like the Battle of France in 1940, where the French and British fought it out in the month of May, fighting the Germans. But by the end of May, early June, the Germans had broken through. There was nothing between them and Paris, and the French had no choice but to surrender. I think you're going to be looking at a situation where the Ukrainian government has no choice but to surrender once the Battle of the Donbas is over.
Okay, $64,000 question. When will that be?
Vladimir Putin, in a speech he gave last week, made it clear that Russia is operating on a Russian timetable. That means that experts like me, we don't matter. It doesn't matter that my understanding of Russian military doctrine would suggest a very rapid advance a rapid envelopment and that this war would be over sooner rather than later. Putin said that the work of the Russian army is very literal. And what he meant by that is by the book, that they're going slowly, methodically, and they're eliminating the Ukrainian forces piece by piece in a manner that maximizes destruction among the Ukrainians and minimizes the losses among the Russians. So only Putin can tell you how long this will be. The bottom line is the outcome is inevitable. It doesn't matter how long it takes. We know what the outcome is going to be, and that is the annihilation of the Ukrainian army in the Donbas. They're literally, and the interesting thing is, even the West has recognized us. Even Zelensky has recognized us. In his speech, he said, if things don't change, we're going to lose all these troops. And you look at all the talking heads on American mainstream TV. I don't know what it's like in England, but they've all changed their tune from, hey, the Ukrainians kicked butt north of Kiev to this is about to turn into World War II style fighting where all of the advantage belongs to Russia. So even those people who have been sustaining the narrative of the brave Ukrainian resistance have to admit the reality of the map. The map doesn't lie. The map shows that Russia is ready to execute this and finish this double envelopment that will result in significant number of Ukrainian troops being trapped, and they will either die or surrender.
A week, a month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months?
Well, here it doesn't matter what the Russians do. Now we're talking about the Ukrainian army. You know, let's again, we have to give credit where credit is due. These guys have been fighting like tigers. They're very professional. They're very determined. And they're putting up a very resolute defense. But they're only human. And their tanks require maintenance that they're not getting. They require fuel that they no longer have. They require ammunition that they've run out of. Same thing with their armored vehicles. The same thing with their artillery. The troops are tired. They're hungry. They're thirsty. They're confused. And at some point in time, all of these factors add up to the collapse of the Ukrainian military as a viable military force. That hasn't occurred yet. The Ukrainians are continuing to put up a good fight. But I think with the sustained pressure being placed on them by the Russians, the way they are, that this pressure is being increased exponentially with massive firepower and maneuver. I don't see the Ukrainian army lasting more than a couple of weeks.
Well, that's interesting. You said a couple of weeks. I mean, the obvious, really best outcome here would be for the Ukrainian army to surrender and for Zelensky to talk peace, or, you know, some kind of settlement.
Negotiate.
You know, I saw Boris Johnson wading in saying, I can't see that Zelensky should negotiate. And of course, the British position has been all along since 2014. Don't negotiate with the Russians. We're going to get Crimea back. We're going to get Donbass back.
So,
which, of course, is actually encouraging the Ukrainians in the delusion that they're going to win, which, of course, is absurd.
That NATO is fighting Russia to the last Ukrainian.
That's right. And if the Ukraine, if, you know, Zelensky is a kind of chameleon type character. He was originally elected promising that he would negotiate with the breakaway republics. He then went to the front line where, of course, the military had been gradually building up their forces in opposite the breakaway republics for some time. And this is ultimately the Russians have already got the documents showing that they were about to carry out an offensive against what's left of the Donbass and Luhansk republics. Don't forget that this Ukrainian army, made up mostly of people from the West Ukraine, so they're not locals, they are occupying the areas like Mariupol and other parts of the Ukraine which voted to leave the Ukraine in 2014. So they're not wanted by the locals. The locals don't want them there. And they're, you know, they may be fighting like tigers, but they're actually not on their land. It's the land which is actually what's going to become these independent republics. And, you know, all of the stuff about Mariupol and the terrible slaughters there, I've been seeing stuff where the Azov, you know, the Marines that have been captured are saying that they knew they didn't have any real support in Mariupol and that they were basically just shooting civilians at random to try and stop them leaving the city. All of this should be making the news in the West, including the Bucha massacre near Kiev.
Bucha.
Where it's becoming quite clear that it was Ukrainian paramilitaries that killed all these people.
Well, we'll be hearing a bit about that from Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, in a little while. But one of the things I couldn't resist the temptation to ask Scott Ritter about, because most of the interviews that have been done with him over the last year or so, and in fact I remember before the Ukraine thing too, interviewing him, you can quite often hear dogs yapping in the background.
The dog you hear most vocally is a Pomeranian, a breed known for their vocalization at inappropriate times. And his name is Breck. We love him to death. He's 12 years old and still cantankerous and full of Ben Bigger. We have a tiny Chihuahua named Machismo, who oftentimes joins the Pomeranian in a bark fest. And then we have a mixed Australian Shepherd coyote named Tegan, who is generally quiet, but when she decides to get involved, you can tell by the baritone nature of her bark.
So that's Scott Ritter's three dogs that you can quite often hear when he's doing these interviews about Ukraine. You know, no one else brings you that really important info, folks. But Martin, I'm quite concerned about where this is all leading. Do you think NATO might be trying to, at some point, drag themselves in? Because there was a programme on the BBC we're going to hearing some clips from in a minute about exactly that. The NATO does want to get engaged. And the other thing that's pretty clear is that the NATO countries were very much involved in the sinking of the Moskva from an intelligence and possibly an electronic warfare point of view.
Well, the Russians may conclude that therefore NATO has crossed their red line, in which case it's not a question of whether NATO wants to be involved. If the Russians start sinking NATO ships, which of course they might do, then there you are. It's happened, isn't it?
I mean, one of the things that's been suggested was that the radar of the which would detect anti-ship missiles and that sort of thing of the Moskva had been blinded, knocked out potentially by a drone or by electronic warfare from the NATO countries. From there's an AWACS aircraft called the P3 Orion, which apparently was circling around over Romania, a US Navy aircraft, at the time of the attack.
Well, it may be that the Russians are well aware that NATO were involved in the sinking of the ship. What they will do, as Scott Ritter suggested, they will, for the time being, they won't give any information out about what happened, but they will put that in their little black book. And if I was a British sailor sailing in the Mediterranean, I might be going to my bunk rather scared.
Now, you were suggesting suggesting that there may, because there was apparently a fire near RAF Welford, which is on the way from Bristol to London. Now, that's on the M4. It's on the north side of the M4, and you get these little signs saying works unit only, around about junction 14, I think, around about the Hungerford junction. And there was a big fire there. They had to close the M4 on Easter Saturday. But there is some suggestion that possibly this was something done by the Russians. But I'm looking at the actual location of the fire. It's on the other side of the motorway to RAF Welford. RAF Welford is used by the US as well, apparently. Of course, there's quite a lot of RAF bases, which are not least of which is Menwith Hill or Lakenheath, which are really US Air Force bases. And, of course, near here, Fairford, Martin. These obviously would be potential targets for even nuclear weapons if this starts to escalate.
Yes, but the real danger here is that we go into the escalation phase by some accidental clash, as happened in the First World War. And
it wasn't an accident, was it? That was an assassination.
Well, it was an assassination, but of course the way that played out was that it then caused an escalatory spiral.
Well, it was like a kind of a domino effect, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, that is the danger here, is that both sides, in theory, would not want to go head to head.
To what extent?
But
they
may end up going head to head anyway. The Ukrainians, the Ukrainian far right, they are very fanatical, and they would like to see NATO go to war with Russia, including potentially the use of nuclear weapons.
Well, it's very strange.
It's crazy.
It's very similar to the whole situation with the Israelis, isn't it? Because they keep egging on this whole possibility of having a war with Iran, knowing that the Americans would come to their rescue.
Yes, and so they've got a vested interest in doing provocative things. And what we should be saying both to the Israelis and the Ukrainians is, we're not going to be incinerated because you've got a beef with the Iranians or with the Russians.
Need
to negotiate.
It's the total opposite that's happening over
Indeed.
Here.
Totally irresponsible encouragement of more violence. And let's send more weapons. The thing of sending more weapons is just virtue signalling. The weapons will never get there, and if they do get there, they won't turn the tide. So all that's happening is politicians in the West are making themselves feel better by making sure that more Ukrainians get killed. And what they should have been doing from the get-go is talking to the Ukrainians and saying, look, you're going to have to cut a deal with the Russians, start talking to them
seriously. It seems to me that Ukraine is just, you know, somewhere on their chessboard, and they don't care at all lives or the future
of
their citizens.
And of course, Zelensky ought to actually, you know, do the sensible thing and cut his ties with the West and say, look, let's fix this with the Russians. The Russians would welcome that with open arms. They'd say, that's about right. If you're prepared to negotiate and compromise, then we're prepared to negotiate and compromise. Let's do it. And that's what they, that's why they've approached this in the way that they have. The negotiations between Russia and Ukraine only began when the special military operation began. There have been 8 years where nothing has been said.
Yeah, you said that. Anyway, the programme is called Where's the Line? This was on Tuesday evening on BBC Radio 4. It was pitched out as a debate. Of course, that piqued my interest. So I thought, a debate on the BBC? Surely not. About Ukraine. So, and sure enough, there were four participants, all of whom were Russia haters. I mean, really, you know, all of their views were anti-Russian, blaming the Russians for everything and not taking into account the fact that Ukraine has been run by the West for the last, gosh, 8 years at least, and since the coup. And they didn't seem to have recognised the coup. They don't seem to also have recognised the idea that there would be referenda down in the Crimea or in the Donbass regions. None of that was talked about or referenced whatsoever. And, of course, the 15,000 people who live in the Donbass who've been killed over the last 8 years by the Ukrainian army and by the Azov Battalion Nazis down there, which is the reason so that the Russian political forces, with Putin actually reining them back initially, finally decided we're going to go in and stop this because these are ethnic Russians and this is an attack on us as a people by the West using people like Zelensky, etc., as proxy. So let's have a listen to, we got several clips from this the discussion program that went out called Where's the Line? And by the way, full version of the interview with Scott Ritter up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. And of course, the full version of this will be available for you to listen to the whole thing if you like to, too. But I've taken some extracts from it. We're going to start with the BBC's Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen, which is, I mean, obviously the Ukraine is not in the Middle East, but Jeremy Bowen has been sent up to Ukraine to do reports from there anyway. And here he talks about what he says are the Russian atrocities. So he's obviously decided that that these bodies that have been found could not have been killed by the Azov Battalion or by the Ukrainian army. It must have been the Russians.
Jeremy, you just spent 6 weeks in Ukraine. Were you prepared for what you discovered in those areas that the Russians retreated from?
Yeah, to be honest, I was. I sort of expected it. I've seen the Russian way of warfare before in Grozny, breakaway Republic of Russia in the 1990s, in Chechnya, in Syria, extensively. I was in Aleppo when just after the time it was completely flattened, the eastern side, by the Russians and the Syrians. So yes, I have. I was expecting to see some pretty bad things, but I think what is different about this war, what makes it significant, is not so much the level of violence or killing, which is terrible. It's not so much the way that the Russians have driven a tank through international law. It's who's involved. It's the fact that the world's leading powers are looking at each other, staring each other in the face, armed with nuclear weapons in a way that they haven't, not even since the end of the Cold War, since quite deep into the Cold War. So I've covered many wars in many years at the BBC, but this is, to me, the most significant thing that I've been reporting on in that sense.
Well, clearly, the stakes are much higher in this confrontation than they were in the previous wars that he's suggesting. But of course, the Russians in Syria have actually pursued a very, very softly approach. That's why it's taken them so long to clear ISIS out of the places that they're captured, because they don't just go in there with guns blazing. He mentions Grozny there. That was in the early stages of the transformation in Russia. And of course, the Russian army at that stage was very
Yeltsin era.
That's the Yeltsin era. And of course, backed by the West. And in actual fact, the Russian army at that stage was very, very unprofessional. It had been run down for years. It was all conscripts.
Yeah, in fact, quite a lot of people.
And the only way they knew how to fight was just by blowing everything up.
The other point was quite a lot of the soldiers in the 1990s hadn't been paid for months. They were selling off military equipment on the black market.
That's right. So what's actually happened is that the Russian army has been professionalized. Virtually everybody fighting in the Ukraine are full-time soldiers. They're not conscripts. And they've also, because they've been fighting in Syria, they've learned all sorts of things that you only learn by actually doing.
But what about you these atrocities for? That he talks of?
Well, they've already made up their mind that the Russian army is a bestial organisation that carries out bestial atrocities.
But that's not the job of a journalist like Bowen to do that.
In actual fact, the evidence is piling up that the Ukrainians are carrying out massacres of people they don't like, who they think are too pro-Russian. The two British guys that have been taken prisoner, they were saying that they want to be exchanged for Medvedchuk, who is the leader of the opposition in Ukraine, who's actually been taken into custody by Zelensky as a traitor. And Zelensky himself said treason will have consequences. And the SBU are actually going round murdering and torturing the political opposition to Zelensky in Ukraine, none of which is reported in the Western media. The Ukrainians are presented as these freedom-loving Democrats fighting the evil Russians. And in actual fact, they're going round. They take the view that Russian-speaking Ukrainians are not real Ukrainians. And that's why, for example, they fired that rocket at the Kramatorsk railway station, because those were Russian-speaking people trying to get out of the way, and of course they don't want them to leave.
So why does the Ukrainian army and NATO seem to want to retake the Donbass region, which is mostly Russian-speaking, but they don't see them as real Ukrainians?
Well, no, what they want is they want the land, but they don't want the people on it. They could kick them all out, drive, ethnically cleanse them out, which is exactly what the Croatian army did in Krajina in the Yugoslav war. When I drove through the Krajina the day after the Croatian army had gone in there, and everybody had left. A few old ladies stayed behind, and they were shot.
You know what
and
this
that's
is?
What, that's what they want. They want the Donbass, but they don't want the Russian speakers who live there.
This is Lebensraum.
It is, yes. I mean, and it's a pretty cruel truth. I mean, this is a civil war between two, you know, rather distinct, they're related people. I mean, the Serbs and Croats are related, the language is related, but there's an awful lot of antagonism between those two groups going back to World War II. Okay. It's exactly the same in the Ukraine.
Okay, so our next clip from Where's the Line, this bizarre programme, which was pitched as a debate, which wasn't a debate at all, which is looking at how NATO could get engaged with the Ukraine war. And this is from General Sir Richard Sheriff. He thinks that there should be a massive supply of weapons to the Ukrainian army, and he's a former NATO commander in Europe. Obviously, he's one of the main people on the anti-Russian side of this so-called debate, with nobody whatsoever on the Russian side.
The red line remains, as Douglas said, that attack on a NATO nation. In terms of sustainability, I think that we have seen over the last 3 weeks, ever since the heroic defense of Kiev and the battle for Kiev, which, let's put it on the line, was an outstanding achievement by the Ukraine armed forces, there has been a window of opportunity. The Russians retreated. They were defeated. And in every campaign, there's an opportunity to seize the initiative. And the initiative could have been seized better, I think, if there had been and if there is a massive supply of weaponry of the sort of things that President Zelensky and the Ukrainians are asking for. So my feeling is that this is the time for NATO to take risk and provide that support. There's a but, though. To do that, NATO has to be ready for the worst case, and the worst case is war with Russia. And that requires a fundamental mindset shift in the nations of NATO. And we're a long way short of that at the moment.
But he's saying that NATO have got to get ready for war with Russia now, Martin.
Yes, and he's saying we're a long way ready from the fact that people in the West haven't, public opinion isn't ready for war with Russia. And even if they were ready for war with Russia, how are you going to fight it? The Russians are there with their main armed forces. We have got our armed forces scattered all over the world. Even if the US decided it was going to concentrate all its armed forces in Europe to fight with the Russians, it would take them at least 6 to 9 months to get them into place. And by that stage, the war would be over and the Russians would have won. So it's just silly talk. And of course, he talks about the Kiev being bravely defended and all the rest of it. The Russians retreated because they'd had a meeting with the Ukrainians in Istanbul, and they agreed to withdraw from the forces from around Kiev as part of, you know, negotiations. So they weren't defeated. They could have stayed and fought. They chose not to. And then, of course, the Azov battalion went into Bucha and killed all the people who had somehow cooperated with the Russians during the occupation. And then they claimed that the Russians had done it. That actually may be an Achilles heel of all of this propaganda in the West. If we can expose what happened at Bucha and make ordinary people in this country understand, these are your allies, they killed those people, not the Russians, and you say you want to give more weaponry to these people, I say no.
So another one of the participants, along with Jeremy Bowen and this guy, Richard Sheriff, was a US army commander, Douglas Lute. He points out that there are precedents for NATO getting involved outside their own area in the Balkans. And this little contribution from him is followed by Sir Richard Sheriff, who seems to be the he kind of repeats the same thing again and again. We've got to get ready for fighting the Russians. We've got to get ready for World War III. But let's have a listen to these two now, the two US and British military contributors to this so-called debate, with nobody on the Russian side at all, talking about the Balkans operating, NATO operating out of its region, and also about preparations for a Third World War.
NATO has only actually suffered one attack in its 70-plus year history to date, that actually crossed the threshold as being defined as an armed attack on the territory of one of the member states. And that, of course, was the day after 9/11 in 2001, NATO took the decision to invoke Article 5, the Collective Defense Clause of the NATO Treaty. So there's only been one clear crossing of the, if you will, Article 5 threshold. But NATO's taken it, as you mentioned, in the Balkans, later in Afghanistan as a result of 9/11 and so forth. In Libya, NATO has taken military actions where it has reasoned that a more secure neighborhood outside of the alliance promotes security inside the alliance. So security in the neighborhood was important. And I think certainly beginning in the mid-1990s, the Balkan Wars are good examples of that.
Couldn't exactly that, Richard, apply to Ukraine in the neighborhood?
It absolutely could. And I think, therefore, all bets are on, everything is on the table. But I come back to my point about the imperative of NATO recognizing that it's got to be ready for the worst case. And until NATO is ready for the worst case, it can really make no decisions about any form of intervention, escalation, or the like. And as I say, the worst case means getting ensuring that our people, our populations, our states are mentally ready and physically ready for the worst case, which is war with Russia.
And you think they still aren't?
No, we haven't begun to think about it. I'm sorry, we just haven't begun to think about it. Life in Britain goes on very much as it has always done. Think what happened after Munich in 1938, which, okay, is seen as the high point of appeasement, but at least there was a mindset changed that allowed the preparations to be put in place so that when war was declared in September 1939, the country was readier for it than it would otherwise have been. Defense spending is way down. We've effectively disarmed in a whole range of areas. To be ready for war means not only preparing our populations for it, it means rearmament, it means seeing defense spending at levels as they were probably during the height of the Cold War, it means regaining and rebuilding lost military capabilities, and it needs political leadership for that to happen.
But a lot of them are quite long-term things, aren't they? They take time.
Well, it's a come-as-you-are party, so we've got to put everything into the shop window that we've got now, which we could, I'm sorry. NATO is an alliance of 2.5 million men and women under arms. Thus far, the alliance has put something like 40,000 onto the eastern flank.
So two points there, one made by Douglas Lute from the United States, and one which is about, in the neighbourhood, NATO could operate. We're just trying to, make Libya more secure, for example. That's why they got involved in Libya, because it was in their neighbourhood. And also then Richard Sheriff comparing Munich 1938 to Kiev 2022.
Well, don't forget, they wheel out Munich at every opportunity, don't they? It's appeasement, appeasement, appeasement. In actual fact, what happened at Munich, as Alex Craner pointed out on this show, was that the Czechs were ready to fight the Germans, and the Soviet army said that they would come to Czechoslovakia and fight with them. And at that point, the British pulled the plug. And of course, they could have been stopped there. But of course, to make the comparison that every war that's ever been fought is always, we mustn't avoid appeasement. I feel like saying to the Americans, hang on a minute, you weren't involved in World War II until after Pearl Harbor. So what are you talking about? You weren't involved with appeasement. You didn't have any relationship with what was going on whatsoever until you were dragged in. So the historical analogies are pathetic. And of course, the other point I'd make to the general is this. If you are going to build up British armed forces to take on the Russians, pretty absurd idea if you think about it, then it's going to take you at least 10 to 15 years to do all of that. And by that stage, the Russians will have won the existing war. What are you talking about?
Jeremy Bowen also contributed this whole concept of to what extent the superpowers are already involved and NATO is already involved in Ukraine.
The Kremlin said that continuing to arm Ukraine risked unpredictable consequences.
Yes, and by unpredictable consequences, a lot of people thought that they were directly referring to some kind of nuclear use of nuclear weapons. You know, if you go back in time, you go by the rules of the original Cold War. In that war, it was sort of within the game for the superpowers to supply countries that were directly fighting their opponents. For example, the Americans gave a lot of weapons to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan when they were fighting the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, after the mid-60s, was the main supplier of weapons to the North Vietnamese army fighting the Americans. And that didn't set off a Third World War. It was considered to be something that was allowed under the rules that they had at the time. Now, I don't know if President Putin wants to change those rules or certainly threaten, but I certainly feel that it would be seen as a provocation and it would be a risk, but maybe that's a risk that is within the boundaries of something that could be taken.
Well, the obvious answer to that is that if you want to supply weapons to the Ukraine, and obviously they are supplying weapons to the Ukraine to kill Russian soldiers, the Russians could decide to say, we're going to kick the Yanks out of Syria, and we're going to retake the Golan Heights from the Israelis. Because if we're going to have a global war, it ain't just going to be about the Ukraine, is it? You've got plenty of interests and facilities all over the world, and if we're going to have, you're allowed to supply our enemies in Ukraine with weaponry, well, maybe we should be supplying your enemies with weaponry.
I mean,
Yemen, for example, kill the Saudis and the British and American troops who are embedded with them. And of course, ultimately, the Iranians and the Russians may decide that they're going to clean up in the Middle East. Because in actual fact, if there is rules where you can supply weapons to people, then we can supply weapons to people, and the whole thing will escalate. And there will be a world war.
But it's not just
the West
about
will lose.
Martin, I mean, it's quite fair for Jeremy to talk there about the Chinese supplying weapons to North Korea, the US supplying them to South Korea, etc., isn't it? Because there's a precedent set after World War II for this. This has been happening continually.
Okay, so the fact is that if you're going to say it's okay for us to supply weaponry to the Ukraine, incidentally, of course, from a military point of view, as Scott Ritter would point out, it's a waste of time. They won't get any. Don't forget, the main Ukrainian army is now surrounded. They can't get anything into them. So supplying more weapons to Kiev won't make the slightest bit of difference to the military balance on the ground. It's just a lot of posturing. And, of course, the danger with this posturing is that if the Moskva was sunk by NATO shenanigans, then, of course, the obvious answer for the Russians to do is pick their moment and sink a US or British ship with all hands on board.
A flagship.
Yeah.
I mean, an aircraft carrier.
And don't forget, the Russians have got these hypersonic missiles now where they can hit anything anywhere on the planet within half an hour. So they could easily decide, right, well, this is the base that's sending the Americans are sending stuff into Britain to go onto the Ukraine, but we're going to sink the ships as they cross the channel, for example. And you can see how quickly this could escalate. And of course, it'll escalate so quickly that the general will not have time to prepare the population for the war or to increase defense spending. And of course, we'd have to print the money unless we're going to raise taxes on the wealthy. And of course, during the Korean War in the 1950s, the top rate of tax in both the United States and Britain was 95% plus.
Russia's tested a new ballistic missile this week called the Sarmat, and China has one called the YJ-21. This is, I mean, you know, these are new ballistic missiles, apparently the very best in the world, massive range. I know the SAMR, I was looking at it yesterday, 15 multiple independent re-entry vehicles, MIRVs, or each of which can carry a megaton warhead in one of these. It's a public, in a public display of force, Russia's newest heavy long-range intercontinental ballistic missile blasted off on Wednesday from a test silo in Plesetsk in western Russia. The media said it flew nearly 6,000 kilometres, that's nearly 4,000 miles, before hitting targets in Kamchatka on the other side of the vast country. The intercontinental ballistic missile, SAMAT, or ICBM, has been in development for many years and designed to replace the older Soviet legacy S-18 missiles. They are meant to fly around the planet, showering strategic targets with multiple nuclear weapons in a nuclear war that no one wants to fight.
Well, if people say no one wants to fight it, but the danger is that by this basically loose talk, NATO keeps saying we want to fight the Russians, but we don't want to admit we're doing it. Or yes, we do want to admit we're doing it, and ultimately the Russians are going to take them up on it.
Do you know what
if
the
you
range,
say you want to fight us? Maybe we will fight you.
Do you know what the range?
If you want it, you can have it.
Do you know what the range of this is?
It can go, but I imagine it can probably go at least 20,000 miles.
Well, actually 22,000
yeah,
miles.
Yeah, which is so enough to hit anywhere on the planet.
It can go, well, not only can it go hit anywhere on the planet, it can also go the long way round.
Yeah, that's right.
So what's the significance of them testing this and letting us know about it right now?
Well, the Russians have been upgrading their missile forces, as have the Iranians, for many years, because ultimately missiles are going to make navies and air forces obsolete. In fact, they've already done it. It will take at least another generation for the Western powers to develop similar stuff, and they haven't got the time.
Well,
it's too late.
The Where's the Line programme on the BBC didn't really even address the question of where's the line at all. Nevertheless, even though they had the four people on there from the anti-Russian, pro-NATO people on there, including a woman from Chatham House who was nearly in tears, a Ukrainian woman. Chatham House, of course, being the Royal Institute for International Affairs, along with the Council on Foreign Relations, being set up initially funded by the Cecil Rhodes and the Round Tables in order to take over the world. That was Cecil Rhodes' idea. But anyway, the point here being that there are other systems, aren't there? For example, there's satellite systems, cyber warfare systems, electronic warfare systems, economic warfare, Martin, that the Russians might take issue with that the NATO countries are using against them.
Well, I mean, everything is going to be used, hopefully not nuclear weapons. But we are now in a, you know, this is, you could say that the war's already started. If you're living in the Ukraine or in Syria, I mean, there's been a war, the World War III has been going on in Syria for a decade and more now.
Yeah,
if you live there, you know.
It seems to me they're throwing absolutely everything they can at this, other than actual troops on the ground. But then, of course, special forces.
Yes, I mean, what they're doing is they're creating this whole mythology of the Ukrainian guerrilla forces that will somehow resist the Soviet tanks and so on. It's just not feasible if you think about it. The Ukraine is very, very flat. It's a very flat place. There's nowhere to hide. There are no mountains. There are just urban areas. And you can't really sustain a guerrilla war in those circumstances. It's not Afghanistan. So it's basically, as you can see, a fairly conventional battle of a World War II kind, with tanks, artillery, and, you know,
Not World War II, is it? Because this very rarely happened in World War II, where the army decided to deliberately embed itself in amongst loads of civilians and housing estates.
Well, they did. I mean, if you think of the Eastern Front, the Germans didn't give much of a stuff about civilian casualties. And nor did the Russians either. I mean, basically, if you were in the way, you just got mashed up. I think what the Russians are doing now in Ukraine, which is exactly what they've done in Syria, is that they bottle people up inside wherever they can bottle them up, and then they whittle them down. And
of course, the German army could have embedded itself in Paris and caused an awful lot of trouble for the Allies, couldn't it? But they decided, no, we don't want to do that. Let's go.
No, they didn't. I mean, they got driven out in 10, but you know, there was actually.
They weren't driven out, they retreated from Paris.
well, don't forget there was an uprising in Paris itself, led by the Gaullists and the Communists, and that's because they wanted to, you know, to show that they weren't just going to be liberated anyway, by the British.
Final
the
clip from
British
Where's America. The Line, which never addressed Where's the Line at all, is from Jeremy Bowen, bless him. What if Ukraine starts to lose the war? Well, a lot of people would argue that they've already lost it. But anyway, let's have a listen to see what he had to contribute, if anything.
I think there's a really big decision potentially that might be necessary if the Ukrainians start losing. Now, if you think back, it's less than 2 months, but February when all this happened, the expectation then among non-Ukrainians especially was that the whole thing would be over in about a week. And there was no move from Western countries, NATO, to actually intervene and help. No one expected to. But the real sea change has come because the Ukrainians militarily have done so well. President Zelensky has gone from being a slightly joke figure, an ex-comedian, to a really respected war leader. And we've heard President Biden in the US and Boris Johnson here has even been to Ukraine, absolutely trumpeting their support for him. So here's the scenario. What happens if in, I don't know, 3-4 weeks, 5 weeks, the President Zelensky, in one of his appeals online, says, we are losing. We need air support or more from NATO, or our armed forces are going to be cut to pieces. What then does NATO do when it's faced with almost with an ultimatum from its own ally?
Well, what they will do is they can't do anything. I mean, what can they do? It's absurd, this kind of conversation. If they try to put in a no-fly zone, which is what he's hinting at there, the Russians will simply shoot down your planes. Not only that, they will attack the bases from which those planes flew. That could be, for example, Fairford down the road from here. It would take a Kinzhal missile less than 20 minutes to hit it. And then you've got to make a decision. Are we going to fire our missiles back into Russia? And of course, the Russians will have some capacity to prevent that. And you've gone from if the Ukraine is losing the war and there's nothing NATO can do about it. If they wanted to intervene in the war, just think how long it took to prepare to attack Iraq. It took nearly a year to get all the forces in place to do it. So are NATO capable of doing that? They haven't got the forces to do it, as Scott Ritter will point out.
Well, you're saying two and a half million men or something in arms. Yeah, but NATO, of course they have.
Well, yeah, but they're all over the place, aren't they?
Well, they can concentrate them.
Well, if you concentrated them, the Russians will simply hit them with their missiles, won't they? Because they'll see the punch coming a mile off. So what are they talking about? There's no realism about either the political or military situation there. It's just a lot of narcissistic, self-referential stuff. And, of course, that doesn't win wars.
Well, demonstrations have been taking place in support of Ukraine, particularly in London. One was on Saturday, the 9th of April, and this was organised by PCS and other trade unions in central London. And the journalist Michael Tracy was down there. He recorded this rather curious chant from the trade unions.
Oh, 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 Ukraine! Oh, 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 Ukraine!
So, arm Ukraine, put an end to Putin's reign.
Yeah, I read a report about this demonstration. It was Paul Mason spoke at it, and there is an element on the left in Britain that sees the Ukraine as something like the Spanish Civil War, and that the Ukrainians are fighting fascism, Russian fascism.
So the British should basically ship themselves over there and join the Ukrainian army.
Well, the thing that gets me about all of this is it's just projection of fantasy stuff. What military difference do you think it would make if either NATO intervened or people just decided they were going to go and fight for the Ukraine? They can't get into the Ukraine without being killed. The Ukrainian army is now surrounded. How are you going to rescue them? By sending more weapons to the Ukraine. It's not going. What's going to happen is that there will be probably quite a rapid end to this now, as Scott Ritter was suggesting. The Ukraine is going to be partitioned, and the rump West Ukraine, which will not have access to the sea, I would pretty much guarantee that, because don't forget Transnistria broke away from Moldova in the 1990s, and that's about basically a Russian-speaking sliver of land which could be linked up to the Crimea. And if you look at the map of Ukraine before the war, all of the Russian-speaking areas are all in that eastern and southern quadrants, and they will become independent of Kiev. And that what will happen in Kiev is quite possibly a civil war between people who are blaming Zelensky for surrendering and all the rest of it. And the Russians will just watch. And there's no way, no military way at all, that NATO can intervene in this war and win. They can't. The Ukrainians can't win. NATO can't win. It's only a matter of time. There's going to be a partition of the Ukraine, just as a partition of Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Kosovo is not going to be part of Serbia.
Anyway, some good news.
Donbass isn't going to be part of Ukraine.
Good news this week. There was quite a scare midweek about Gonzalo Lira. He's now fine. He was a journalist who was based in Kharkov and Kharkiv. And he spoke on the George Galloway show. In fact, I think I should put a link up on our show page to the interview on the George Galloway show. Fascinating stuff, but no time for clips from him today. Just to say, yes, he's fine. It turns out, Martin, he was arrested by something called the SBU, which is like a Ukraine secret police, but he was released. And there was an enormous campaign over in the West. What he did is he released a film saying, because he had been what he called doxed by the Daily Beast, who were saying, look, this guy's a lunatic and an idiot, and really just encouraging the Ukrainian secret police to dispatch him. And he said, if you don't hear from me over any 12-hour period, that means that I could be dead.
Yes, and I think because he's got a relatively high international profile, he has, for now, he was taken
he's
in.
He's not allowed to leave Kharkiv.
No. Well, they don't want anybody to leave these urban areas, because they're going to use the population as human shields. That's right. That's the only strategy they've got. The SBU is a thoroughly, thoroughly nasty organisation. And I've been reading, I think it was on Consortium News, there's a detail of all the people that they've been kidnapping, torturing, all of the large number of political parties which have got any kind of pro-Russian sentiment have all been banned in the Ukraine. The leader of the main opposition party is in custody and may be swapped for the British prisoners. And Zelensky and his goon squad are basically saying anybody who shows any kind of sympathy for the Russians is a traitor, and we're going to kill them. That's who we're supporting, those people with that kind of attitude.
Someone who weighed in saying that we should be supporting the Ukrainians with lots of arms this week was good old Richard Branson. He's part of something called the B Team, and he thinks that we have to stop driving so quite. If we just decelerate by 20 miles an hour or so, go a little bit slower everywhere we drive. I suppose if you're in a city, he means maybe 10 miles an hour slower. And if you're on an A road or a motorway, maybe it's 20 miles an hour slower. And he also thinks that we have got to switch lights off in our houses, and this will help the Ukrainians, Martin.
Well, it's just all this narcissistic stuff. It's like it's all about us, all about us, all about us.
No, he's saying it's not. It's about Ukraine. Well, we've got to find ways to support him. Let's have a listen to him, and you can comment after we've heard from good old Richard Branson speaking on the BBC this week.
We are a group of business leaders, which we feel that it's time for business leaders to speak out on this. It's not time for neutrality, and we're all with one voice, as most people do, feel that Russia's invasion is completely unprovoked and completely unacceptable. We've basically met to try to decide what needs to be done. The first thing we feel needs to be done is a massive increase in military aid. NATO governments should immediately transfer all the weapons that Ukraine has asked for. And then the second thing is that Europe's dependence on Russian oil, gas and coal. We just got to stop that dependence immediately, and we've come up with a number of plans to show that can be done immediately without great pain for European countries or consumers.
And don't you think if it was that simple, they would have done it by now?
I've been a 55 years a businessman and an entrepreneur, and I think sometimes business leaders can see things and be able to act more quickly sometimes than politicians. I mean, our plan is very simple, and that is, and it's similar to what the IEA have also published, that we take 2.7 million barrels of oil out of the system by doing things like reducing the speed limit for cars and lorries, by cutting back our air conditioning slightly, our heating slightly, and so on. Now, that would, by freeing up 2.7 million barrels a day of oil, that completely covers all the imports that Germany make from Russia, and other countries take from Russia, and it leaves a lot over. The benefit of that is that prices will come down, and inflation will come down quite dramatically. And so basically there is a way of doing it that is a win for Ukraine. It means that the billions are not going to Russia. A win for the consumer because this small sacrifice of driving a little bit slower or just turning the thermostat down by say 1 degree. That is going to save their money in their pocket right away.
Well, interestingly, it seems that the British have allowed a possibility of people be able to buy oil from Gazprom. I can't remember the reference to it. I was reading earlier. So despite all the huffing and puffing, they're still trying to find ways that they can get oil from Gazprom. And of course, diesel, which I mentioned last week, the Americans have increased their amount of diesel that they're buying from the Russians, even as they're telling the Germans that they can't buy any from the Russians. Now, the consequence, what the Russians are doing is they're not cutting off the gas and oil supplies. They've not cut off the gas supply to the Ukraine. They're at war with the Ukraine, but they're still supplying gas, and they haven't attacked any of the gas terminals in Ukraine at all, because they don't actually want to hurt the Ukrainian people who are civilians. Nevertheless, what will happen if, as going forward, if they really are serious about getting rid of Russian oil and gas, is that the German economy is going to crash. Deutsche Bank will crash, and then Wall Street will crash, and that will happen quite quickly.
That sounds like a bit of a domino effect.
Well, this is actually very much
like 1929, isn't it?
It is like, well, it's like 1929. It's more like 1914, because in 1914, everybody thought that two things would prevent war. One, because of the integrated nature of the world economy, business people would just say war's unprofitable, we're not going to do it. And also there was another delusion that the working class in Germany and France would go on strike and prevent the railways from running, and therefore there wouldn't be a war. What actually happened is when the war broke out, immediately the world's stock markets crashed. I mean, London and New York crashed. And then the government had to take over the whole of the economy for the duration of the war. And all of these people like Branson and all these other and the general going about war, that means rationing. That means increasing taxes to 95%, like when we were fighting on the Battle of the Imjin River in the 1950s. Branson, you're going to have to put your fortune on the line. If you want to fight the Russians, you need to hand over your fortune to the government to pay for weaponry. But you're not going to do that,
okay? So Peter Ford, the former Syrian ambassador, and Scott Ritter, various other analysts all say, well, of course, NATO doesn't want a nuclear war. Are they right?
Well, nobody wants a nuclear war, but the danger is, as happened in 1962, is the possibility that we just end up having one because people are too lazy-brained to prevent it.
Sergei Lavrov is a Russian foreign minister who did a terrific interview with India Today this week, and it's around about 45 minutes long, and I'll put the full version of it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where he explains how this all, I think the first 15 minutes or so of it, he really goes into detail of how we got where we are with the Russians actually coming in, and explaining things like armed groups were sent from Kiev down to the Donbass and to Crimea to take over those parliaments, including neo-Nazis being sent down there to do that job, to take those parliaments by force, which the locals repeat then repelled them. And that's how this whole thing started, basically. But anyway, he had some very interesting things to say about the atrocities that the Russians have been being accused of. So we'll have a listen to this clip, but I'll put the full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Sergei Lavrov, Russian Foreign Minister, speaking to India Today.
We are investigating the atrocities of the neo-Nazis battalions of Ukraine and of Ukrainian armed forces. There is a special commission created in Russian chamber. We have it. Anyway, there is a public organization which is very experienced. They have been discovering the fakes staged by so-called white helmets in Syria, in many other cases, and we will not cease our efforts to establish the truth. We are used to the fact that the United States, United Kingdom, and other Western countries have a very interesting habit. They just throw in a news when they believe this news would work ideologically for their benefit. And then when it comes to facts, and when more and more facts are discovered, which put big question mark on the assertion, they just lose interest. 2007, London, poisoning of Mr. Litvinenko. Huge outcry. The trial begins, and after a few weeks, the trial is made public, which in UK means secret. Until now, we cannot get the facts about what actually happened to Mr. Litvinenko. 2014, Malaysian Airlines, Boeing, shot down over Ukraine. We presented huge amount of facts. We requested that we be part of the investigation. No way. Ukrainians, who did not close the skies during the conflict, were invited to this special investigation group. Russia was not. Malaysia, as the owner of the plane, was invited only 5 months later, after the Australians, the Dutch, and Malaysians agreed among themselves that anything coming out of this group must be subject to consensus. Meaning, Ukraine, which did not close this case, had veto power on this investigation. So we could not get the truth on this one as well. 2019, Salisbury poisoning. The people disappeared. The only proof which was made public is highly likely, as Theresa May said. The Brits insisted on expulsion of Russian diplomats by most of the European countries. And when I asked my friends, did they provide the proof beyond the public statements about highly likely it was Russia? They said no, but they promised to. I checked 1 year later whether this was done. It was not done. And so on and so forth. 2020, our opposition blogger, Mr. Navalny, was poisoned. We asked the Germans, and we immediately, you know, responded to the German request to let him go to the Berlin hospital. 24 hours later, after the request, he was flown to Berlin. We don't have any confirmation who was flying with him, where did they get the bottle, which is the key, you know, element in this investigation. And when we asked the Germans to show us the formula which they discovered in his body, they said, this is military secret. It is us who, until now, insist on the truth about Litvinenko, about the Skripals, about the Malaysian Boeing, and about Navalny. The stories which they stage in Ukraine these days are from the same nature.
Yeah, well, the Operation Beluga, we know that's what it's called because Paul Burrell, who's the head of the French anti-terrorist squad, tells us what the name of the operation is. It's like Gladio. We've been basically, MI6 and the CIA have been creating all of this kind of, you know, what are essentially theatrical events which some of which are more dangerous than others, in order to make the Russians look bad. And they've been doing it for years. And therefore, of course, you've got a population which have basically been brainwashed into believing that the Russians, for their own evil reasons, just like killing people. That's why they're bound to have been committing atrocities in the Ukraine, because it makes no military sense for them to do it, but they're just like that. That's the kind of thing they do. And there's lots of people who actually buy into this nonsense.
Yeah, the deep state here in the West doesn't only lie about what the Russians do, they are also very good at doing things like killing their own presidents. And we heard last week about the JFK assassination from James Files, from he's originally 82nd Airborne Division sharpshooter, but also nowadays more recently from the Chicago Mafia as one of their hitmen. He was talking about a guy called Frank Sturgis. If you remember last week's program, Martin, we were talking about this whole idea that the Cuban Missile Crisis was to save face for the Americans to pull their missiles out of Turkey. I mean, some people will say, what do you mean? The whole world was on a nuclear hair trigger for a war.
Well, the missiles in Turkey were annoying to the Soviets, as then was, and they were basically saying, you know, if you don't do something about this, we're going to take action. And what they did, and of course the Russians, you know, we're talking about the generals earlier, the Russians could decide that they're going to give nuclear missiles to their allies in Latin America. Nicaragua, for example, could be
Venezuela,
and Venezuela could have Russian ships with nuclear weapons.
Well, so this would be,
them.
I think, a bit more real than that back in the 1960s, because the idea really was that that some of the people very close to the Central Intelligence Agency knew that there had been a negotiation before the Cuban Missile Crisis, saying, "Well, we need something where we can sell this to the American population," saying, "Well, we'll pull these." And the military, of course, will pull these nuclear weapons out of Turkey, but only after, you know, sort of climbing down from a potential nuclear war situation. But he was talking, Files was talking about a guy called Frank Sturgis, who was one of the people involved in the Bay of Pigs, training Cubans up to attack the Bay of Pigs, which was just before the Kennedy assassination. Some say one of the major reasons for the Kennedy assassination. Sturgis was also one of the people involved in the Watergate, which was after that. It was a decade or so afterwards. But here is Frank Sturgis interviewed. I thought, who is this guy? Let's have a track him down. And here he is being interviewed by Bill O'Reilly in the United States, talking about Richard Nixon, the JFK assassination, and possibly why JFK was assassinated when he was interviewed by Bill O'Reilly in 1977.
Sturgis says the combined information from Hunt, Butterfield, and Haig was edited by the CIA and fed to Bennett, who then gave most of it to Bob Woodward of the Washington Post. Sturgis goes on to say that the decision to politically ruin Nixon was made after Nixon demanded to see CIA files on the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and, most importantly, the file on the assassination of President Kennedy.
In fact, several times the president asked Mr. Helms for the file, and Mr. Helms refused direct order from the President of the United States.
Why? What good would that do Richard Nixon to get those files?
I believe that Nixon would have uncovered the true facts that had been covered up for many years about the assassination of the president. It would take the heat off of him on Watergate.
Do you think that Richard Nixon was ever in any physical danger?
Yes, absolutely. He's lucky he didn't get killed. He's lucky he didn't get assassinated like President Kennedy got assassinated.
It's quite likely the case that Nixon had fallen foul of the deep state. That seems completely believable to me. I mean, presidents don't get removed like that unless somebody has got a definite interest in getting
it. It makes it absolutely clear the Central Intelligence Agency is running the whole show and deciding who's president. And also, of course, doing very much what they did in 1961 with the death of Dag Hammarskjöld from the United Nations. It's almost as if the Kennedy assassination, followed on from that. So there was a very clear signal sent to the United Nations. If you try and intervene in our, basic games in Africa, then you're going to get killed, so probably not a good idea for anyone from the UN to try that anymore. And of course they did the same with Kennedy. I think it's also interesting to look at the technique involved, the actual modus operandi of the CIA when it came to assassinating John F. Kennedy, because Alan Frankovich, the filmmaker behind the Gladio films, behind the Maltese Double Cross, about the Lockerbie bombing, another film which was a 3-hour film he called On Company Business, about the role of the Central Intelligence Agency right the way through the 1950s, 60s and 70s. Frankovich talks about this rather cheeky little sneaky technique the CIA have of sending out orders to cancel an assassination just before it happens so that they can cover themselves.
The thing was really to get people in the CIA who were talking for the first time to sit them down, have them tell the audience what they did, and to show consistently over a 30-year period of time that there were certain methods that were used and they had nothing to do with national security, essentially. They had a lot to do with justifying these operations, whether they're against Chile or Guatemala or Angola or in European context. They had a lot to do with intervening in the internal affairs of a whole series of countries to force them to comply with what presidents of the United States wanted these countries to do. And these kinds of activities are not something which just happened in moments of crisis. They go on every day in every country of the world. And they're the official but secret foreign policy of this country. And they're done specifically on presidential orders. And what will happen in 1974 and 1975, and I believe it happened primarily because one of the political parties, in the form of Richard Nixon, started using the same agency inside this country not against dissidents, mind you, because I think against a major political party. And therefore, when that starts happening, you have to tell your guys, look, this far, no further. And you start investigating them, you have to make a real investigation, because they know all kinds of secrets, they know where all the bodies are buried, and therefore, to rein them in, you have to investigate them. But the conclusions, I knew in 1974, 75, they would never conclude that these were official government operations, that American presidents had ordered them, because the very nature of the CIA is to conduct these operations in secret, in such a way that if the CIA is caught, they take the responsibility themselves, and the President of the United States is protected.
Is that why they said that the CIA was a rogue elephant out of
control? Exactly. That was the conclusion. And if you look, for instance, if you look at the CIA, the assassinations the CIA claims they planned but never executed, you will find in the several cases the Church Committee went into, the Lumumba assassination, the assassination of the Commander-in-Chief of the Chilean Army, that a few days before these people are bumped off, a cable will go out saying, don't do it, guys. And nevertheless, it goes ahead. And this is, again, standard CIA operating procedure. These operations are done to preserve the cover, and so that the United States then can take a moral position while eliminating someone that they consider to be an obstacle to what they want to accomplish.
Well, that's Alan Frankovich there, part of a fascinating interview done for the Alternative Views series back in 1982. He died in 1997 in suspicious circumstances. One of the greatest filmmakers on the planet, actually, Alan Frankovich was. And he's talking there, Martin, about this whole sort of policy, really, of sending out a message just before an assassination saying, cancel the assassination, just so they can cover their backsides.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically, as what's it Pompeo said, we steal, we cheat, we lie. Ha 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 ha. And and everybody was laughing.
Well, they're like the Lords of Chaos, aren't they? Anyway, the James Files, who was the Grassy Knoll shooter from the Chicago Mafia, was with the hitmen, gave a fascinating interview back in 2002, where he described something very similar happening with the JFK assassination. An abort team being sent down to Dallas saying, no, don't do the assassination. But they knew that the assassination was going to go ahead, because the people who were in charge of the assassination were all for it, and that the people that came down from the CIA to say, well, I think you better think twice about this, had no authority at all. And so the assassination went ahead. So I think it's quite fascinating to hear this same idea from two different people completely.
Chuck hadn't got the Dallas that week. He only come in, I'd seen him that morning. I hadn't seen Chuck in person until I went with Johnny Roselli to Fort Worth and come back. Johnny Roselli got out of the car, went upstairs, Charles Nicoletti come down. Mr. Nicoletti got in the car with me, and we drove to Dealey Plaza.
How did Roselli get to Dallas?
At that point, Roselli, he mentioned to me, Johnny Roselli, we was on the way to Fort Worth, And I asked him, when did you get in? He said, I got in this morning. He said, I got in early this morning. He said, I hadn't been here a couple hours. And I said, how'd you get in? And he said, he got lucky. He caught a ride on a plane that's sponsored by the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. I said, how the hell did you manage that one? He said, I got lucky. He's had somebody there. I didn't ask no more. He didn't elaborate any more than that. I didn't dig any deeper than that.
He didn't mention the board team at that time.
Not at that point.
Okay.
So we got all that. Now then, when we get back, I still don't know that he's there on an abort mission. I have no knowledge of that at this point of the game. Johnny Roselli got out of the car, went back in the hotel. I waited maybe 5 to 7 minutes for Charles Nicoletti to come down. When he got down, Mr. Nicoletti got in the car with me and said, let's go. We took off. I said, where to? He said, take me over by the plaza. We went over. We parked. It's drizzling rain. We get out. We're walking around. This is the first time that Johnny or that Charles Nicoletti has even mentioned to me about an abort team. And he asked me. While we're walking around, he asked John Charles Nicoletti asked me. He says, how do you feel about being backup? I said, what do you mean backup? He said, how would you feel about being backup as a shooter for me? I said, what happened to Johnny? What's with Johnny? And he said, Johnny's a little bit paranoid on this. He says, the CA's called a hit off. He said, they don't want the hit to go down. And I said, well, what'd you say? Chuck's exact words were, fuck them. It's going anyway. And I told him, I said, well, what about Johnny? He said, well, Johnny will be with me, he says, but he's not going to be a shooter. He said, he doesn't want to go against the orders. He's been told he flew in here specifically to abort this assassination.
Is it fair to say he got cold feet?
No. When we was talking, when I asked him about Johnny Roselli, I said, how come Johnny's not going to be a shooter? He said, well, he doesn't want to go against the orders of the CIA. He said, what he wants is that he wants to call off. He said, he flew in here as an abort team. He said, they flew a plane here specially with him on it to tell us to call it off. And so I asked him at that point, I said, what'd you say? He said, I said, fuck him, it's a go. If we're going to do it. He said, Jimmy, he says, you know we can't call this off. Only one man can stop it. He said, and he's here. If he wants us to stop it, he said, he'll notify me. He said, I'm not going on somebody else's word. He said, as poor as it is right now, I have a go. He says, from the boss, he says, we're going.
Now, who was the one man that could have stopped it?
There was only one man. Charles Nicoletti did not say his name at that point. He just said the boss. I knew he was referring to. He was referring to Sam Giancana.
Who was he?
Sam Giancana. He was the number two man at that time. A lot of people's going to tell you he was number one. But not true. Tony Accardo was still running things. He turned things over. He had Sam Giancana running all this operation and everything. But Tony Accardo was still the man, and he was still calling the shots on whatever went down, whatever was done.
So anything Giancana said had to at least have the okay of...
It had to be sanctioned, and it had to come through Tony Accardo.
We're talking about the Chicago crime.
We're talking about only the Chicago area alone.
So that's the Chicago Mafia hitman, James Files, telling us how it all happened, how it all transpired, with one of his colleagues coming down from the CIA to say, no, don't do it, in the knowledge that actually he didn't have the authority to stop it, and the only people that were the bosses of the Chicago Mafia. So, you know, it's interesting, this kind of interaction between the Central Intelligence Agency and the Mafia, Martin, and also their ability to cover their, at least an attempt on paper to cover their tracks.
Well, the CIA has been intimately connected to the Mafia going back to the 1940s and before. And if you think about the international drugs trade and the funding of the Nicaraguan Contras and Lieutenant Oliver North, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, it shouldn't be at all surprising to people that they cooperate. And they've been cooperating for years. Meanwhile, of course, most people are blissfully unaware of how criminal the elite in the West actually are.
And the official
are.
Position, of course, is that Lee Harvey Oswald killed it. But it's totally impossible, just from a basic practical ballistics point of view, for Oswald to have done it. And also, of course, he was quite clearly a patsy. He was killed by one of the Dallas Mafia guys, just as he was in police custody. He was murdered.
Well, I mean, obviously this is an ongoing saga,
Is it really?
Yes, we're still talking about it. Well, we're talking about it,
sure. But you know what annoys me is, you know, it's there's masses of evidence about what actually really happened, and yet there's still books coming out and you know, stuff coming out of the FBI, etc., with completely different stories. If none of this is, you know, we don't know what happened. We do know what happened. We do know who did it, and we do know why.
Yes. And of course, Bob Dylan actually released a single a couple of years ago called Murder Most Foul, which is basically about the JFK assassination. So, you know, this is, I mean, it goes to the
root. It was a significant period, that, wasn't it?
Yes.
The beginning of the 1960s, with the murder of Dag Hammarskjöld at the United Nations and the murder of JFK, a very strong signal was sent out that freedom was, you know, basically on the way out.
Also the murder of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. I mean, the West has been criminalized for many decades. And of course, the Russian secret services are very well aware of all of these things. They're not prepared to take their word for it. And why would they?
Well, thank you, Martin. We're going to finish with a little clip of James Files just explaining the transformation that took place in his life whilst he was in Stateville Prison in Illinois.
I think probably the biggest change in my life is, and let me go back just a little bit further. Before this change took place, I had no emotions or no feelings, basically speaking, for anyone at all. My family never came first. The agency came first. Crime family came first. Everybody was always ahead of my wife and my kids. Wrong. I know that. I know that now. I've got probably a lot of regrets, maybe some remorse for a lot of the things that I did do. I'm sorry at times I wasn't there to see my kids go to their little school plays or do their dances, recitals, or whatever. I'm sorry I wasn't there for the birthdays, for a lot of the Christmases. But those things are part of my life growing up. These are things that I accepted. Because to me, other things were more important. My family, my wife, my kids, they were way down on the list of priorities. Wrong, I know. After I got here, and when I got here, this place was pretty well wide open. The place was very violent, wild. And you know, we just had recently had several lockdowns due to deaths here. It wasn't natural. But a few years ago, what happened to me was, I went to sleep one night. I had a lot of hate in me. I had a lot of anger in me. I had a list of names. Boy, I want to start writing down names, and I want this person, I want that person. A lot of hate in me. But I woke up during the night. I found Jesus sitting by my bunk. A lot of people say, oh, it's a dream. Maybe it was a dream. It's a dream to you, a dream to him. To me, it's real. And I'll ask him, I says, what are you doing here? And he said, I've come to tell you, there's only one way. He said, the Father sent me to tell you. He said, that I'm for real, God is for real, that I'm for real. He says, the only way to the Father is through me. So we said, we talked for a little while, and I went back to sleep. The next morning I woke up, all the hate was gone. I used to wake up and come out of my cell every morning. It's not, what am I going to do today? It's who am I going to have to kill today, or who am I going to have to stab today, or who's going to try to stab me, who I got to fight, you know. Because there have been a lot of fights here, a lot of stabbings. But I had a new feeling in me. I was real light. You know, I felt like I loved everybody. You know, hey, how you doing? Boom. I talked to people I never talked to before. I even talked to the cops. Hey, how you doing? What's going on? Hey, nice day. Well, after a little while, I started slipping back again. I got back to being the old Jimmy again. I started getting these angry feelings back, wanting to fight. You know, you look at me the wrong way, I'm going to grab you, slam you into the wall, you know. Whatever you do. I got a second visit. And when I got the second visit from Jesus, it's really got my attention. And at this point, I'd already heard from this one girl, this one lady. I don't know if I should name her on tape or not. But I become romantically involved. I fell in love with her. And I love her with all my heart. Probably love her more than I've ever loved anything in my life. But we were talking and writing, and she was a good Christian lady, and she had told me a few different things. And so the second visit I got, Jesus told me to get my life in order. The Father was going to call me home. I thought, well, Jesus, I'm going to die. And I'm going to die right away. And so I told her on the phone. So she was crying a little bit. You know, I was a little sad over, you know, this and that. But then I was reading in the Bible, and I was reading in Matthew chapter 24 about the earth giving the birth pains and all this. What God was telling me, Jesus was telling me, God's not calling me home this stage of the game, but be prepared. Get ready for heaven so I can have a life hereafter. And I'm reading all about this in Matthew. And then it struck on me what it was. So I called her up and I told her. And so But like I say, since then, I've lived a whole different life here. I used a few words of profanity in this interview strictly for the reason of what was said. There was actual words verbatim. But when I'm not, like, not in this interview, I try not to use vulgar language. I try not to hate people. I try to maintain good thoughts. But in here, that's hard to maintain good thoughts. Very hard in here. But I work at it very hard. And I pray every night, every day. I don't run around with my Bible. I don't run around trying to tell you all about the Word of God. That's not my job. You want to hear about it, I'll be more than happy to sit down and talk to you about it. But I don't try to push it on anybody. We have a lot of different kinds of religions here.
So that's James Files talking about his encounter with Jesus coming to sit on his bed twice because he didn't quite listen enough the first time, apparently. The Grassy Knoll shooter, Chicago mob, hitman, originally 82nd Airborne Division sharpshooter, and there was a much longer interview, which is on the one of the long conspiracy classics programs that we did a long time ago, which is up on Radio 4 All. Also, just a couple of things before we close. If anyone has been having problems with Radio 4 All, please do let me know. Apparently, they've moved over to a new server, and some of you have written to me saying that you've had problems listening, downloading, etc. So please, if you've had any of those problems, if you can make some notes, take some screenshots, and email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. I'll forward them on to the people that run Radio 4 All so they can have a look, see what's going on. A lot of people having no problem, but some people having trouble. So if you can just let us know the circumstances. And this is particularly when listening to the MP3 downloads on Radio 4 All, rather than downloading them and then listening to them. So please do that. Also, we've got final item. I mean, we're going to do the Green Fascism next week with Mark Musser. The final item is just to tell you about this incredible hoard of interesting documents from Operation Market Garden, which has come into the public domain. It's being auctioned off. I think the asking price is around £35,000-£40,000. But you're talking about something like 80... airborne reconnaissance photographs, some maps, including a supposed original map of the Battle of El Alamein. Of course, these things could potentially be forged, but certainly from my amateurish eyes, they certainly look real. But the most interesting part from my point of view is 25, 30 or so, or maybe 40 battle order documents of Operation Market Garden marked top secret. And these were collected by a person who was in the parachute regiment and collected, and they're being auctioned. So if anybody would like to see, I'll put some of the documents. I've got some scans of them. I'll put them up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But the main thing is to try and make sure that these go to a good home. That is, to somebody that wants the official record to be heard rather than buried, because there's an enormous political battle, as several people have told me, over Operation Market Garden, that they don't like going anywhere near Arnhem on the anniversary because the whole thing has been so politicised. So Tim Saunders told me, who wrote the book on Nijmegen, who's a historical writer. So the idea is to try and keep these at someone buys them, that we'll share them with the public in some way, or put them in a museum for people to see, rather than bury them as history is so often buried. So some fascinating documents there, and anyone that's interested, please do let me know by emailing me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk or by whatever means, and I'll try and make sure that there's some of those documents so you can see what's in there, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk tonight. Quite an amazing find, actually. So time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. But you may have some problems if you're trying to listen on the website. Do please send me interviews, story tips via Not the BCFM Politics show page at thisweek.org.uk. You'll also find there the podcast, full length interviews, story links, the comment page, email addresses, and even subscribing to my weekly email list and donations. This week, oneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter @TonyGosling. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft here in Bristol. and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and military disinformation is the norm in the UK today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses here, the glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and we'll credit you here. Although GB News did a pretty good job this week in getting out all that stuff about the three times more likely to die if you've had a booster jab. That's the sort of information that the Nazi printing presses and the Nazi transmitters don't like to go out. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing an enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 6 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is new from Red Planet.
I do love that tune. Brand new from Red Planet, Detroit style. That's called Sex in Zero Gravity. 6 minutes away from the end.